out, today's program will be listening to a submission from the IFP.
And all the grandstanding. By next week, Thursday, we'll have come to a consensus. And then the following week, when we have open meetings with your camera here, we'll be fighting again. So for next week is the week of harmony and peace, because there's no television cameras, there's no elections looming, and we'll all be saying to each other, Comrade Peter, what do you think, Comrade Peter? You say, no, Comrade Karim, I don't agree, but it sounds convincing.
Chairperson, I already said, never call me Comrade. You can call me one Peter, but not Comrade.
If you think it's bad for you, we have to look at you all day here, and then in the evening we see you again at home.
I don't know why your co-chair raising this issue of the TV when I'm trying to present my TV. Does it mean that I don't want to be seen or something?
Thank you, Chairperson. This is a broad principle of the IFP that we have decided to put forward. We will be dealing, when we're dealing with the bills, we will be dealing with the matters and the bills, paragraph by paragraph or line by line. But these are the broad political position that we have. The IFP has constantly voiced a strong opposition to the proposed disbandment of the Scorpions, that is the DSO. We believe that the decision of the majority party was made without a reference to the merits and successes of the Scorpion, but it subjected knee-jerk reaction to the unit's investigation high-ranking ANC members. The decision to disband the Scorpion risks of political self-protection is irrational and will not advance the fight against the organized crime and corruption. However, it is clear to the IFP that the majority party will force its will on the public, notwithstanding the outcry, and will disband the Scorpion. In the face of this reality, the IFP has decided to participate in the legislative process in the hope that our contribution can limit the damage to our country's crime-fighting ability. We therefore have a choice to accept that they will be a successor or not. A successor to the Scorpion, or to retain the Scorpion as they are. The points we raised below are intended to strengthen the proposed unit's ability to effectively combat organized crime and corruption. We talk about the independence. The most important non-negotiable principle of the IFP is that the unit be completely independent. Similar to the ICT, but not the ICT analysis. Similar. It should not report to the National Commission of Police, but should report directly to the Minister of Safety and Security. The Minister would be accountable to Parliament for the unit's budget and administration, but won't be allowed to direct involvement in investigation or decision regarding to the unit's investigation. The head of the unit will be accountable to the latter. The unit's mandate must be clearly spelled out in the legislation. The type of organized crime to be investigated must be similarly clearly spelled out, so that the role confused and jurisdictionally conflicts could be avoided. The unit's mandate is in respect of relationship with foreign law enforcement agencies must be cleared. We have seen that most of the time that there is a blur when it comes to these things. Selection of the DSO. At present, the amendment bill provides that the National Commission will select former members of the DSO for employment in the new unit. This is completely unacceptable to the IFP, as the Commissioner is given too much direct discretion in this respect. The bill also fails to spell out what criteria should be followed in the selection process. The IFP believes that the head of the unit, in consultation with the Minister of Justice and Safety and Security, should select the personnel he or she requires. This must be done according to the specific criteria that must be included in the bill. It should spell out the criteria, because some other people will think that by passing matric and have a driver's license is fine. On the other side, we know that when you are dealing with DSO, we are not dealing with those things. The bill does not make it transferring members of the DSO would retain the same condition of employment as they now enjoy. The bill must do this specifically and must make it clear that labor laws will apply to transferring members. The legislation must make it clear that the unit will be able to request the temporary secondment of any state official to assist in its investigation. This could include specialist prosecutors from the NPA that will then form part of an investigation. They will not head the investigation team, but can be consulted by the team and provide valuable advice or direction. The same would apply to the specialists from other law enforcement agencies, including SARS and intelligence services. We are taking the cue from saying that we can have a specialist within the DSO itself, but if you need any specialist from other areas, that specialist can be assisted to appoint other specialists from other areas to assist them to make sure that thing is done properly. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Honourable Ndlovu. Maybe before we get into questions, yesterday we've forgotten to extend an apology for Chairperson, Honourable Maggie Soju, that her child has been admitted to hospital. That's why she's not around here. Honourable members, are there any questions? Honourable Magwanisha?
Chair, it's not a question. It's a comment. I think the IFP have engaged in progressive oppositions. They have a principled opposition to the disillusionment, but the manner in which they have participated in the process is remarkable. I think if we can all learn from the IFP, I think we'll go a long way. We might not agree with some of the things raised, but I think the spirit in which they have been raised, I think it's in keeping with good oppositional politics. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks for the comment. Is there any?
There is a point of clarity. Are you addressing a particular party apart from the IFP? And a particular person whose name starts with D and has double barrel surname? You don't have to answer.
Out of order.
This is part of it. We can say anything.
Are there any questions?
If nobody
can. I know you are sailing so smoothly.
Can I just come in? Can I just raise some quick things? One, you see this independence idea, your paragraph one. That's model three. So it's part of the discourse anyway. Model three. I think it's the DSO model, the one they originally came with, right? On the issue of the mandate, we're all agreeing. We're all agreeing that the mandate is not clear enough. And I think what we're seeking to do, if I'm correct, is we want to be more specific, but also allow a certain measure of flexibility. Because organized crime, we understand, it changes all the time. And you can't keep coming back to Parliament, you know, to change the law. So there's some measure or other we have to find, whether the minister or the president, whoever, had some latitude within the constraints of what the parliamentary committee would allow to change within a certain framework the meaning, but that will have to be brought to Parliament. We have to approve in some way. On the selection of DSO members, whatever model we're going for, well, I guess we get model one. The other three, we agree with what you're saying, right? On the conditional employment, we agree. I think everybody agrees that. On five, that model of secondment, it could apply to model two to four. So this will be inserted into the discussion of modelling next week. While I'm at it, the study group tomorrow from 10 to 4 continues with the ANC. And we will meet next week for 3 days to finalise the modelling. And after that, we take it to our respective caucuses. That's on Thursday the 25th. And then we come back and then take our final positions in the week after the 25th of September or 28th of September. Well, thank you
very much, Chairperson. I must say that these are the broad principles that I have brought forward. I know that I'm a member, a full member of this committee, and I will engage in detail with the bills, both bills, wherever when they are being discussed, and I will be a member to the subcommittee and so on and so forth. That's why I didn't
give over to my co-chair to do it, tearing up issues and overview.
I'm going to be very quick. I had the opportunity only on Monday to read Director Jacob's reply. It's a 55-page reply that members were given. It's not the 55 pages. The last page has got a clipping from the Pretoria News. Now, he has obviously replied, but to be fair to him, I think, you know, there's more depth here in the written text than what came out. And we're all different personalities, and some of us are able to speak freely, and others of us are a bit more subdued. So I think in fairness, we shouldn't use style to replace substance. And I'm going to quickly take you through some very useful things that he said. And because members have got the text, I'm just going to refer you to the relevant section. What's interesting is this constant claim that the SAPS can't investigate complex cases. There's quite a copious reply, quite a substantial reply. And it sets out, for example, things he has said, but I want to remind members that the SAPS it is that settled many major high-profile cases, including the nuclear proliferation case, which is complex, multidisciplinary, and required considerable skills, the Burak Mark matter, the Creon case, and so on. And the important thing is that page 2 of the text, it talks about this organized crime initiative of 2006. It basically talks about, and I'm going to quickly take you through what is said here, that since July 2006, the organized crime component of the SAPS, the Asset Forfeiture Unit, and the NPS, the National Prosecution Services, have undertaken an organized crime initiative where they jointly address organized crime from identification thereof to conclusion of criminal prosecution. So in many ways, they have been working in a multidisciplinary fashion. This initiative ensures that dedicated prosecutors, note, are assigned to complex organized crime investigations, has empowered both the investigators and prosecutors, right? And since then, 79 prosecutions have been instituted. And the working methodology is serving us well, he says, and in some places, the investigators and prosecutors, note, share the same office location without resorting under one department. That is Model 4, and to some extent, Model 3. So in other words, this is quite instructive, this is what I'm saying. Now, there's a safety and security committee that can tell. Look, it's got nothing to do with you, Commissioner Jacobs. The same would apply to you, Andy Langare. We, as a parliamentary committee, are cautious when you say this. Like every parliamentary committee, everywhere in the world, you're cautious about the executive. Whether this is actually accurate or not, justice people cannot say. It's for safety and security people to say. Okay? We don't know. But as an ordinary committee member in parliament, I'll be cautious. I think you're exaggerating there, but even if 80% of what you say is true, usually my own view is that if 60% of what the executive says is accurate, that's great. That's a norm for me now. 14 years in Parliament. Nothing to do with you, Commissioner. I'm not saying you're misleading us, but my own criteria is to say drop 40% of what the executive's exaggeration is spin and so on. And if 60% of what they say is good, I think it's great. So if 60% of what you're saying here, Commissioner Jacobs, in my view, I can't speak for my co-chair, it's great. But I'm just drawing people's attention to this. One, that they are operating with multidisciplinary. And the most crucial point is the working methodology is serving well, and in some places, the investigators and prosecutors share the same location, office location, without resorting under the same department. Then I want to draw your attention to the organized crime unit. It goes on page 4, is responsible for specific violent crime in the form of bank robbery, cash in transit robbery, and ATM explosions. In respect of ATM bombings alone, the OCU units of FAPS arrested for the period 1st January 2007 until 10th August, that's quite recent, 215 suspects. So he's communicating that they have been effective, contrary to the perception that we have. Certainly justice people, I think, the sense we have is that it doesn't work. Then on page 6, this is very instructive for processing our legislation and getting a sense of where SAPS is. It says, the SAPS in respect of organized crime, as well as the investigation of serious economic offenses, supports and uses not only the Troika principle. Now note, they are using the Troika principle, but also a multidisciplinary approach where other skills are required in order to successfully investigate a matter. So, Commissioner Jacobs is saying, not only did they bring prosecutors, investigators, analysts together, but they bring the whole corpus, you know. For example,
fast as you will seek us. So they are actually doing it according to this thing. I only discovered this on Monday. In some organized crime offenses, such as in Polokwane, I hope you're not referring to our conference, obviously, a prosecutor, because Polokwane is no more a place, Baba. It's become a conference. Historic conference. Nobody will know it's a place. They think it's an ANC conference name. Yeah. A prosecutor in Polokwane had been designated to work closely with the OCU and even has an office, note members, even has an office within the prosecution. Ah, I lost myself. Where is it? Even has an office with that unit without the prosecutor and investigator being members of the same institution. The same method is promoted in the rest of the country. And within the prosecution guided investigation project, very interesting choice of words, eh? Prosecution guided, not prosecution led, not prosecution driven, prosecution guided. A subtle but significant difference. Of a large number of prosecutors that are made available to be designated OC projects, organized crime projects. The basic need is that the NP have enough prosecutors available to designate to the OC projects or investigations. It is in our view difficult and not necessary to reflect the Troika approach in legislation. I think the majority of us disagree with this point. We think no, precisely because it's difficult to effect it, it must be in legislation. It is also the multidisciplinary and not only the Troika approach that is necessary, we agree, for successful investigation. There have been many views about prosecution guided, prosecution led, prosecution driven, and prosecution serviced. The same is true in respect of intelligence led and intelligence driven. In short, SAS is in favor of a multidisciplinary approach, and the situation, or the use of, I'll just jump a few things because it'll save time. This includes the use of designated prosecutors in such investigations or projects. In criminal investigations, the investigator must take the lead with the professional assistance of prosecutors, intelligence, and any other support. This can be done in a task team approach. So the other concept that's come up is the task team approach. I think it's the sort of thing that Bulalani says. Bulalani talks of a project approach. They use a task team approach. And Annelies, interestingly, says we should go for both. A project team, multidisciplinary team, linked to a specific case, but also some people more permanently seconded to you. So she's got that option, right? Without it being a requirement, says Commissioner Phillips, without it being a requirement that the other disciplines need to be necessarily employed in the DPCI. In some instances, it is accepted that a need will be identified, for instance, to employ forensic auditors on a permanent basis. In effect, he's echoing Annelies's point by saying that in some instances, so you and Annelies are saying the same thing, which I only discovered to my surprise on Monday. Hands up those of you who read this thing. Hands up those of you who only listen to Commissioner Jacobs. Commissioner Jacobs, with due respect, you don't do yourself the best of service. What's here? Maybe we give you a hard time, but the truth is what's here is quite substantial. As for prosecutors, experience has already shown that a close relationship with prosecutors can be maintained without the prosecutors being employed in SAPs, right? So it's covered in a much more elaborate way. Okay, on the Compare Pay Commission, I think this is a weak argument, but this is what's offered. He points out that the ID observes that numerous presenters use the Compare Pay in different contexts and that it's of no use to criticize or to discuss the use thereof by a particular presenter, and this he thinks is a healthy approach. It's fine. That's your view. In other words, we're all being ideologically driven, but I mean the departments are not meant to be in that sort of way. But the point is, it's a good point. There is, those of you who are interested, there's an article written by Jay Redpath, The Scorpions, analyzing the Directorate of Special Operations, an ISS monograph series, number 96, March 2004. Okay, look on page 12 of his text. You'll find it in the first third line, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, okay? So can members read it? Oh, it's a her. It's Jean Redpath. Okay, Jean Redpath. Well, is it a very long article? Do you know? Can't we get the... Since we've done thousands and thousands of photocopying already, can't we do copies for the members? Lolly? You can come in on Saturday or Sunday to make the copies. You'll get overtime. Pay, think about it. Yeah. You come on your own. Don't bring the other members, then you take longer. Oh, she wants promotion. Okay. Okay, we can promote her now. She can be senior committee secretary of this committee. Okay. Interestingly, Redpath compared the organ.
minutes of SAP. Now, this is an independent person, not academic, and commercial crime with a DSO, also taking into account the budgets, and found that each successful DSO prosecution is worth 214 ordinary convictions, in the sense that the DSO cost per conviction is in the region of 2.6 million, and a SAP conviction, some 11,994 rands. Obviously, Willie will argue, well, it's the complexity of the case, and so we understand. But it's useful for members to know that. I'll skip this stuff, but it's very interesting stuff at the bottom of page 12. Now, let's go to page 13. It will take a considerable time to establish the unit. His reply is that there are a small number of DSO members, probably less than 300 investigators, and with the use of a steering committee, as well as joint audit teams addressing personnel, assets, finance, legal, and information technology, the establishment could be done in a relatively short time. In the meantime, the SAPs and DSO investigations can continue. Now, can I suggest, whatever model we go for, that we agree that we go and visit the DSO. I think we as a party have a mandate for that. And we would like to suggest that we visit the DSO. Can we start facilitating this? We can talk over lunchtime with the opposition parties. But if we go to our caucuses on the 25th of September, whatever decision we take, we can finalize it on the first Tuesday, that's the 30th of September. We can meet here. And Wednesday, the 1st of October, can we tentatively agree that we go with the DSO in Joburg or Tswane? Where are you? Tswane. Okay. So on the 1st of October, tentatively, can we go and visit them? Whatever we do, we report back to them on what this committee has been doing, and by that time, we will either have consensually agreed on a model or agree to disagree or whatever. One of those four models, or model five, will have been decided on. And so, we go back to them and we hear them, and we spend the whole day there. Ideally, we fly in on the Tuesday night, so we start early the following morning, about 9 o'clock, and we stay there the whole day, till about 4. We listen to what they have to say. It's like Eddie Zimbizo. We first tell them what we've done, and we all agree, those who are good people, we want them. And I think it is wonderful that the YCL said what it said. In that spirit, we should go there. We've agreed. So tentatively, those dates. Can we resolve it now? Tentatively, unless something dramatic happens and we have World War breaking out in the portfolio committee next week, Thursday. Let's do it. Any problems with that? Good. Any opposition or opposition? No. You don't oppose just for the sake of opposing, Peter. It's fast asleep there. I can tell you. Sorry? This is a good one. Okay. And don't press releases independently saying this was our idea. Opposition members, can I tell you, Peter? Yeah. Don't issue a press release now and say it was our idea to go. It's a committee idea. Sorry, what's it?
If it's a suggestion, we agree with your suggestion, but an amendment to your suggestion. Can't we spend half a day with the DSO and half a day with organized crime unit? So that we can also get a feeling and an understanding of that.
Because the DSO is so sensitive, we don't go there as a nominal thing. Right. So we go there for the whole day, and the following morning, why don't we spend half a day with the OCU? That's a brilliant idea. It's just that I really think they need to have access to us, the DSO. And, you know, people are going to get sort of traumatized, I think, to exaggerate. Let me be careful what I say. I'm not saying they are traumatized. I don't know that. I have no evidence that they are traumatized. I was using the word metaphorically. I didn't mean to mean it literally. Can I be clear? I'm addressing one person in particular, but more generally a certain people. I was trying to be, the word in English is hyperbole. Big word, it means exaggeration for the sake of effect. So, anybody don't understand the word hyperbole? I don't think I understand it either. Christine, just look it up. It's like exaggerating. It's like being crude. Those of you who read novels, it's like Salman Rushdie, surrealism. It's like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, okay? So, I have no evidence that any member is traumatized. What I mean to say is that in case people are emotionally wrenched, if they are challenged, if means whether the possibility exists, we don't know. But if they are, we are responsible to make them feel at ease, to make them feel valued, to tell them we respect them, and to get really more. love them. Those of them who are not part of the counter-revolution, let me stress, right, before people... That was a joke! That was a joke, please! It's dealing with a question of... Throughout the public hearings, people feel that the DSO is used as an arm of those who want to, and it's theoretically entirely feasible, given experience over 300 years. I was merely putting the question as a chair. That's our job, as to where, how you're going to respond to that, Willie, and we look forward to hearing from you. Presumably you're not an empiricist, okay? You've dealt with that part. Now, deal with the perceptions out there. So, 1.5 days.
Coach, I left it a minute.
Okay. 1.5 days. Are we settled? Okay, right. No, that's not relevant to the overview. Okay, I'm going to go very fast. But it's really worth, I think, members, can I ask the Justice Committee members? I am the Chair of Justice. That all members, can you memorize this document? And I will test you next week in the Justice Committee, maybe the 9:30. I'll say, come on, JJ, page 15, paragraph 2, start. Okay. Yeah, I'll skip the bit on corruption, but I really think it's quite useful stuff. Okay.
Sorry, Annalise wants to know if there's something in the water.
What? If there's what? Something in the water. Okay. No. You know what it is about? It is about fed upness, but maybe I have to do my job. The extended mandate. Oh, dear. The extended mandate of the DPCI, if one takes... Oh, okay. It's about definitions. I think we've covered that, right? And you've got quite useful comments, if I may say so. The point the SAPS raises about, they've said it before, but it's very striking when you see it in text. Some things you've said, Commissioner Jacobs, it's just when you read it, you know, I read it over an hour and a half. It's very striking. The point I think the SAPS is making and underpins this bill is that what they feel is that in the DSO currently, there's almost, to use their words, the militaristic term, a command structure where the prosecutors actually decide for the investigators. I think that's the point you're making. And it's well put here. The command structure of the DSO, it never occurred to me until I read it. The command structure of the DSO entails control over investigators by prosecutors. Note that? Which would make it impossible for the Minister of Safety and Security, if you go the compare-pair route, to effectively exercise any control or direction in terms of accountability in respect of the investigators of the DSO. Now, I know we're going to disagree on this point, but it's instructive. That's the first time it struck me, and I'm sure many of us in justice, that is the notion, SAPS says, that actually the prosecutors are in command of the investigators. I'll skip a lot of the other stuff, which I think is quite good, actually. I'll just skip it because we're running out of time. You want amendments to make it clear, for example, that the DPCI is established as a unit within the SAPS. You think it's not clear in the bill? That's Model 3. Let's come to that when we do. You make it clear that these claims about what you've addressed already, so I think what you say in your text is no more than what you've already said, so I won't cover that. On definitions, we are covered, but let me turn to page 32 of your 55-page document. You are saying that this idea that the divisional commissioner status is too low is not reasonable. Because you're saying, in effect, and I didn't know this until I read this, maybe you said it, but one loses it. You said it, eh? You said it already. Okay, so you've explained that, so I won't cover it. But can I draw members of justice in particular to page 32, where he's basically saying that a deputy national commissioner forms part of the office of the national commissioner and is an extension of that office. So he or she could be described as a de facto national commissioner in his or her area of responsibility. So the DPCI is therefore placed in a strong position. In fact, he argues, in a stronger position than the present OCU. Deputy national commissioners, provincial commissioners, and divisional commissioners are all regarded as deputy director generals, and he goes on in that vein. And then I'll take you to, very quickly, there's other very good stuff here. I'm pleading with the justice people in particular to read it, because we're not familiar with this, and it's quite interesting to read this. I don't know what you want to make of this, but you point out, this is an important thing that you've raised already. We must be very careful not to forego empowering provision, the NP Act, for investigative directors. Right? You've raised that already, but I alert Christine and MPC there to note that because we don't want to have unintended consequences of the bill that we currently have. That's it. I would really say that it's worth reading. I'm then going to quickly take you through the next document, which again I only read on Monday, the DSO operations overview. I'll do it quickly. It's a document done by Peter and Christine and PC and others. I just want to take you through a very interesting definition in their first part, pages 3 onwards. It says that the argument here, and here is where I think people should reply, because maybe the researchers are acting in good faith, John, and they've got it wrong. Much of what they say is in a way a critique of the Department of Justice.
Yeah,
this is the document.
Yeah,
it's very good actually. I only read it on Monday. Hands up those of you who read. I'm doing a job for you, okay? So can you please put in the Bank of Baghdad, in my account number there, $100 from each of you, because I'm doing your work for you. But quickly, the interesting thing that the research unit argues is the difference between what you call a legal mandate and an operational mandate. Effectively, what they say is the problem with the DSO is that it had a legal mandate, but the law provided that there should be an operational mandate, and the problem has been that the ministers concerned did not do their job. Kampepe made the same point, that the interministerial committee did not function. Now, why I emphasize this thing, it's a neat distinction between legal and operational mandate. Whatever model we go for, we have to do the same. We have to provide a legal mandate and an operational mandate. And we have to set structures in the bill, and we have to require those structures to meet. Now, if those structures do not meet, they must answer to Parliament. Now, within the constraints, Enver Daniels and others, of what Parliament can do to prescribe to the executive, there are limits, I think, JJ, to how we can say to the executive that they constitute their internal arrangements, right? But there are other things we can do in a bill. And I think members who are dealing with this section of the bill, what we'll do from next Tuesday is allocate different members to work on different sections politically and get the drafters to start drafting aspects. So we have already the elements of the different models in a text of some sort that can be easily translated into a bill. Now, the first section, part one, page 4. It's interesting, the unit was launched, hands up those of you who knew, in September 1999, actually, before the legislation was passed. Now, Dion's smiling because he's saying, how can the bloody chair of justice not know that? Well, I wasn't the chair until a year ago, right? And hey, you know, who thought I would end up sitting here when I could be canvassing in my constituency and getting elected in the list conferences that are gloomy. 200 reasons for establishment. Interestingly, why was the, just remind ourselves, why was the DSO established, right? 2-1 is clear. There were concerns about the capacity of the SAPS in late 90s to investigate. Now, opposition members and DA in particular, I got a hard-hitting paragraph here, which I did not draft. I'm going to read that to you. The text is here. I'll turn you to the page. It's a wonderful one. I chortled with laughter on the plane when I read this, and I thought, hey, I must go for Dayan. Okay, reasons, Len is okay, but Dayan I want to go for. Okay, concerns about the capacity of the SAPS in the late 1990s to investigate serious and complex crimes. We're going to come back to you, Commissioner Phillips. Is your capacity better now than in 1990s, right? I mean, have things changed and why? But it should be noted, this is what the researchers say. It should be noted, in answer to this very question, these are the independent researchers, Baba, I'm quoting them. It should be noted that SAPS today is not the same organization it was in the late 1990s. And it is possible to argue that the issue of police weakness, Peter, I'm just using the researchers' text, right, is no longer justification for the organizational separation from the DSO. Now, this is taken, interestingly, from the Institute for Security Studies, Nohau, it's a quotation, who submitted an affidavit to the Kampepe Commission, I think, on the 14th of June, 2005. It's interesting. The ISS says, in reply to this question, Commissioner Dick, I don't know how much you paid them, but they're saying that you are not as weak now as you were then. Is that true? Okay, I'm just drawing that to your attention, right? Members can reply to all these issues in a moment. I have no idea why JJ is interfering with Annalise, who is a very productive member of the committee. Can't we swap
certainly to cover that. Okay, the second reason then why we decided in Parliament and the executive decided to go for the DSO is the need to develop new methodologies in the fight against organized crime and corruption. The third reason is the need to build an organization which would be better able to attract, recruit, reward, and retain highly skilled investigators in the police service. Surely we still want to do that, except we have to manage this in the way that doesn't create undue tensions with the average SAPS member. Right. Now, there were existing former investigative directors, and it's partly on the basis of that that we established a DSO. 2.3 says on page 7 that its first director, I recall, was Frank Dutton, by the way, who resigned subsequently for personal reasons. And then I think he was replaced by Percy Son, for those of you who might not know. And then he left, of course, and then Leonard McCarthy took over. Now, the point that is made in this paragraph 4 on page 7 is useful. The legislation creating the DSO took months to finalize. Now, this is the point, Diane. Opposition parties continued to express their fears that the DSO would be the president's, open quotations, president's private police force, close quotations. See, for example, will MMP the Scorpions unease over elite units accountability, Financial Mail, 19th of November, 1999. And that, this is what the opposition felt, there would be problems with the police around term, interestingly. The opposition parties noted that. Fears were also expressed, my God, fears were also expressed about whether such a body, Beetle, would be constitutional, given that the Constitution provides for a single national police service, Diane. Point 10. This is Red Part J, 2004. I'm reading a text right here before me, which I haven't written, and I only read on Monday. And I didn't pay Christine and her person.
Yep, same person. No. You know, you must start from the start when you start with the history of the school.
Okay,
you understand it started with the Mafeking conference of the ANC with the National Criminal Crime Strategy. And you know, in the beginning, they actually reported to the president's office.
Alright. You can come back. I'm really reading to you what the research is. They're not needling you, right? But the fact is, the researchers have written this. Is it not correct, Daniels? I have nothing to do with this thing. Okay. I just posed some questions at the beginning. How does the DSO function and all that? Which questions I can give you? I'll give them 10 questions. And then, on the emphasis you objected. Okay, I've done enough, okay? I make my point. Okay, I will just go through quickly. And no tones. Come on and say, just get my tone. I'll speak in an impassive way. It is claimed that the DSO pioneered a new approach which contains intelligence, this I don't need to read, okay? Investigation and prosecution. In this sense, South Africa is quite distinctive in having this investigative component to a national prosecuting authority in addition to a national police service. Now, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Is this not true, Peter, that we're about the only country in the world, eh, that actually has the investigating component within the prosecuting authority, correct? How many of you knew that, hands up? But JT has to show off, right? Hands up those of you in the opposition who knew that. I bet you didn't. I didn't. You know, okay. But the point is that most of us, did you know that? How many of you, okay? They have to pretend they knew. Now, let's be honest. I didn't. And can I speak on behalf of the Justice Committee?
Well,
I bet 90%. Why, we didn't know. Okay.
Are you telling me that Diane didn't know?
I know she didn't know. I mean, she's never raised this issue. I can tell from the subtext of her question she doesn't know. But being the DA, she will never admit that she didn't know because, you know, the camera is there. But let's talk to her next Tuesday, right? I'm teasing, don't reply. Okay, now this is interesting. How many of you knew on page 7, in the English legal tradition, which was inherited in South Africa, needless to say, well, that doesn't appear there. I'm not supposed to say all this. Okay, I'm just reading to you what you think. Prosecutors do not become involved in criminal investigation. How many of you knew that? I didn't. Powers of investigation were granted to the police, who, on completing the investigation, hand their findings in a form of police docket to a prosecutor. The prosecution, well, we know this is the traditional model. Interestingly, in South Africa, this clear demarcation of functions between prosecutors and investigators began to blur as prosecutors took on a more active investigative role in the late 1980s. A well-known example can be found in the Commission of Inquiry regarding the Prevention of Public Violence and Intimidation, the Gold it became known, which operated from 91 to 94. A further feature distinguishing investigative directorates from those of traditional investigative units is the form of conduct, well, that we know, right? But it's very interesting. The argument is that in an adversarial rather than an inquisitorial system, how many of you knew that it's linked to that? Am I correct, Jan? In an adversarial system, like our system and the Commonwealth system, it is rather exceptional, almost wholly exceptional. Is that right, Jan? To have prosecutors and investigators in the same unit. But if you have an inquisitorial system like you do in countries of Europe and elsewhere, then you can combine the two. Is that correct? More. Now, how many of you knew that? Hands up. Oh, please, JJ, stop showing off, right? Well, JJ has done a law degree, right? The DSO officially came in existence in January 2001, some 16 months after it was launched. And this is a very useful point. Can I thank you, Nadia, and your team? I really think your document is very good. The DSO's legislative mandate was intentionally wide to avoid court challenges on the grounds of jurisdiction. This is the point Willie made, right? But however, and this is the point, the downside is, and this is a very good point, however, such a wide legislative mandate is not very useful, Willie. Therefore, there was a need for an operational mandate. I think this is the best point that's been made in this document. When the enabling legislation was drafted, it was intended that this would be a negotiated operational mandate. Baba, a negotiated operational mandate to influence our legislation. Negotiated between the ministers. At the time, the following was said regarding the nature of this negotiating mandate, open quotes. Please note, members, because this is quite important, take Comrade and Tuli. This is going to influence the legislation. I'm really sure this is really going to influence us. The broad legislative mandate of the DSO was done for legal reasons. The operational mandate, this is what Redpath notes. Redpath is the academic, right? The operational mandate must be political, in the sense that the DSO must sit down, for example, with the Minister of Justice and other key people and work through the type of cases via analysis and intelligence. The DSO must always keep a reserve for serious things that might crop up. The DSO must analyze and audit capacity and decide how many cases people are going to do. The DSO must engage with the police. Notice, engage with the police and everyone involved. Everyone must be on board. There must be a buy-in on every level, from the politicians, the police, to intelligence. The DSO, interestingly, it was said by Redpath, must be careful of ad hoc sexy things, Willie. There must be a set program. The negotiated mandate, that's close quotes, that's from Redpath, right? Now we go on to say, the negotiated mandate was to be determined by a ministerial coordinating committee consisting of members of cabinet. They were to devise procedures to coordinate the activities of DSO, including procedures for the transfer of investigators to and from the DSO, interestingly, and where necessary, the responsibility of the DSO in specific matters. Concerns have been raised that this committee did not fulfill its functions effectively. Therefore, another concern about this has been argued as one of the reasons for the resultant problems. Notice the researchers are saying that one of the reasons for the problems we've got is the MCC not meeting, including intense rivalry. Another concern is that the scope of the DSO's mandate, meaning it's so broad, has contributed to inappropriate politicization of its decisions to pursue certain cases. Note in this regard, concern also relates to issues of accountability and oversight. So can we alert ourselves to this, that having a broad mandate has good and bad sides. One of the downsides is also that it allows the unit to become politicized, either by politicians interfering or by the unit itself becoming political. I will then refer you to the Ministerial Coordinating Committee, was meant to do the following. That's on page 10. Look at the three bullet points at the bottom. Policy guidelines in respect of the functioning of the DSO. I mean, Dion, was this ever done properly? Procedures to coordinate the activities of the DSO with other relevant government departments. Was this actually done? I don't know. The transfer of investigations to or from the DSO and such institutions, I doubt very much was done. Where necessary, the MCC is empowered by the Act to determine the responsibility of the DSO in respect of specific matters, as well as further procedures to be followed for the referral or assignment of any investigations to the DSO. The researchers note the MCC has been largely ineffective. To date, it argues, the researchers argue, it has not determined any policy guidelines. You can respond here. If that's incorrect, you can correct it. But the researchers say you haven't determined any policy guidelines for the functioning of the DSO. It's an astonishingly stark, glaring statement of the ineffectiveness of the MCC. And in much greater measure than I initially suspected, they must be held to account for what we have currently as a mess. And what did Parliament do about it? I mean, okay, we must also ask, what did we do about it? We are co-responsible. Justice Committee in particular. I know I wasn't there, but it doesn't mean if I was there, I would have done anything either. The fact is, it doesn't matter who was chairing and who wasn't. The truth is, Parliament has also been errant in our responsibilities. But hey, what do we get out of this? We should never, never, never allow that to happen. The Ministerial Committee, the researchers must look this up. We can alert Johan and my friend Phillips here, Jacob, that we really want some tough, clear, explicit provisions in the bill and accountability of the executive to Parliament. Given the experiences we've had, we just cannot come back to this mess 5 years from now. On the operational mandate, the researchers point out, in the absence of a negotiated operational mandate, the DSO came up with its own operational mandate, namely, sorry, Ma? Namely, Circular 1. Matters must fall within the areas of the DSO's strategic focus, including drug trafficking, organized violence, taxi violence, urban terror, street gangs, precious metals, smuggling, human trafficking, vehicle theft, hijacking syndicates, serious and complex financial crime, and organized public corruption. There are 14 general criteria, and I draw your attention to those criteria. I'm not going to go through them. They are there. They include a wide range of criteria, and in addition, it goes on to say there were further specific criteria set out. So can I draw members to page 11? It's a very valuable page. Okay? And that's the page that Bulalani, I think we should memorize as justice. That the DSO structure is set out. Though can I ask the committee researchers to please understand, what is SNPU, Peter? How would we know what SNPU is? Page 12. OMD, what's OMD? You explained operational management. Oh, it's there, Special National Project Unit. Oh, I see, okay. No, you have explained, sorry. I must confess that I'm errant now. Okay, so SNPU means obviously Special National Project Unit. The structure of the DSO is put on page 12, but Willie will take us through its current structure. We'll come back to that. Total staff complement, Willie will take us through it. Prosecutors, it's interesting, are the second largest category of people. He'll deal with that. And their job designations, he'll deal with that. Screening at the time of appointment and thereafter, I think we've covered that quite a lot. Salaries, in respect of special investigators, the DSO is consequently not bound by public service salary structures and agreements. Thus, it's able to offer better salaries and benefits compared to, for example, SAPS or even the NPA. It's interesting. Even the NPA, you go beyond that when it comes to your investigators and salaries and so on. Interestingly, special investigators include chemists, forensic auditors, and computer specialists. Performance, it's operating interestingly at 65% capacity, justice members know that. Contraband interdicted was 1 billion rands in 2006 and 2007, page 15. Comparative examples we'll leave for now because modeling exercises we're doing next week, but for members, we would urge those who are coming to the meetings next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to read part two. They've looked at the US system, the FBI, and drawn similarities and differences between that, and they've looked at the UK system, SOCA, the Serious Organized Crime Agency, and there's some valuable insights they make. It's interesting what the researchers say about prosecutors and investigators drawing on the British experience. I'll just note this. On page 18, it says, while the policy paper, before they passed this law, the British evolved a policy paper, and while the policy paper that preceded the legislation notes that closer and earlier links with the prosecution is generally desirable, the decision note was not to place prosecutors and investigators together in the same agency, the British decided. This was because separation was regarded as being essential if the independence of both groups was to be ensured. offices answerable to the Attorney General, working alongside the agency's investigators, co-located where appropriate, so as to provide comprehensive legal advice on the course of cases. Prosecutors must provide comprehensive pre-charge advice to investigators in order to negotiate legal pitfalls, maximize evidential opportunities, and develop strong, robust, and well-represented cases. Prosecutors must provide specialist legal advice, such as extradition, obtaining evidence from abroad, robustly pursuing asset recovery, providing targeted victim and witness cases, and presenting more cases in trial as trial advocates. Interestingly, they also have a board. Now, SOCA is a non-executive chairman who is responsible for the agency's approach. Day-to-day leadership is provided by the Director General of SOCA. And SOCA's strategic priorities are set by the Home Secretary, who also appoints the chair, the DG, and the non-executive directors, and provides the funding. However, SOCA then determines its strategy, and I think its board helps with regard for how best to deliver on its strategic priorities. But we look at models there. The Kampepe Commission, Peter Daniels is going to take us through it, so he'll be able to be better now than he was, because this report was done before the report of the Commission was revealed fully. So we can jump over to overview of the public debate, and frankly there's nothing there that he can say to us that we don't already know, and we've gone beyond March 2008. Interesting point they make, though, is on page 26, paragraph 3. The challenge of overseeing, they note, and holding to account all law enforcement officials, not just those of the DSO, is a very real one. All law enforcement officials are vested with considerable powers that involve the risk of misuse. Managing the exercise of such powers is challenging. I think you're absolutely on the ball there, Peter. However, this is particularly so where, in the case of the DSO, its mandate is extremely wide, and the agency has a discretion power to decide for itself whether or not to investigate a matter. Okay, then they make the observations about intelligence gathering for which they've never mandated. Interestingly, they note on page 27, the location of prosecutors, they note there are legal stroke constitutional difficulties of employing prosecutors in SAPs. It's an interesting point, I didn't realize. The Constitution provides that there may be only one prosecution authority in the country. And as a result, procedural challenges to investigations led by prosecutors in the employ of the police would be inevitable. A solution may be to second prosecutors to the police. Now, whether it's right or wrong, I don't know, JJ and others, but for what it's worth, we have to respond to this sort of thing. I would like once again to thank the last issues they're suggesting to us. We'll come back to when we look at it clause by clause. I really want to thank Peter Daniels, Christine, and Nadia for what I think is a very useful document. And I think there's something facetious. I really would urge members, even if you read 3 pages a night, to read it, really. It's a really good document, actually. I don't know why one of the researchers slightly dismissed it and said, well, it's done in March, and it's outdated, and so on. No, it isn't. It's really good. It helps us. There's at least 6 issues I've identified from here that, if accurate, whether or not, will serve us very well when we're processing the models next week. But I'll put them down on a piece of paper with bullet points. JJ, and then I'm handing over to you, Comrade Chair. And I'll be to sleep now. Thank you.
Maybe you should also suggest that the media read it.
Needless to say, the media, when they summarize it, will get it completely wrong. But try. Try.
Yes, thanks, Honorable Karim, but don't sleeping on duty. They'll charge you. Are there any questions, maybe from members? I recognize Honorable Kola Barnett.
Thank you. Chair, there's just something I've been battling to get my head around for some time, and you've repeated it now, and in reference to this document, I think you added in an item that actually wasn't in here, as is your want. Clarify something for me. Just explain to me what you would have expected to happen. There is this claim, and it is to a certain extent laid out in this document, that the DSO became inappropriately involved in matters involving political figures, that they were targeting them especially, as though they were, that was the only thing basically that they were doing. And this is something that's been reiterated in many of them. Now, could you explain to me what you believe the option was? Now, should those cases, many of which have resulted in convictions, as we reiterated in our submission, now, should those have been ignored by the DSO? Should those people have been investigated by SAPS? Or would the head of SAPS, not those, of course, at home on suspension, but the current heads of SAPS, have found themselves here today under threat of being shut down? I'm not sure where and who should have investigated those people who have been convicted, who are now held up as people who were specifically targeted by the DSO. I can't work out where exactly the ANC would have put those investigations, or is it that you believe they should never have been revealed, charged, and convicted?
That's a fair question to ask. It doesn't derive directly from the report, and we can come back to it at the end of this session this morning. If I can suggest that we look at, I was being semi-facetious, but I think it's in reference to at the time that the DSO was created, there were concerns, I think, amongst the opposition parties that it would become the president's personal police force, as it were. And it could be also abused, I think, was the hint. I'm not saying it's there. So Peter Daniels and them should really reply for what's in the paragraph. Related to that and separate from it, and I'll come back, I'll respond to Diane's question at the end of consideration of this report. But I think really we should be directing ourselves to, is the report accurate? For example, I'm keen to know from Dion whether they're accurate in what they say, that actually what they're basically saying is that nothing was done by the MCC. Now, you're not a politician. We only want you to account empirically whether it's a reasonable interpretation. Not to say you agree with it, but is it a reasonable interpretation? Absolutely nothing was done. And the DSO finally had to do its own circular and so on. Let's deal with what the researchers have said. I brought this upon myself, Diane, and I'll come back.
In your defense, oddly enough, on page 26, it does say on the second bullet point, there's been long-standing suggestions of excessive politicization, etc.
Yeah.
So it is in there.
Yeah.
So
now, you should ask us that, but the researchers might want to comment first. Let's deal with the researchers' report. I'm not running away from your question, I'll reply, but I'm just saying let's deal with what's there in the text. And the questions, I have merely done the job of the researchers. I thought I'll do it fast. You know why? It's easier for me because I can zero in on the particular paragraph. Right, so I've done their job, but they have to reply for the report they have done. And then we deal with Diane's question. That's what I'm suggesting. But we'll come back to Diane.
Another gentleman.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I mean, I think it's an important document that needs to be engaged with, but maybe the one point would be, I mean, as the co-chair has alluded, getting a response from the department or departments to issues raised, if they've got anything they want to say that they disagree with. Then I think we can engage with the document. I've got some questions on the document, but maybe the opportunity should be given to the departments/agencies to indicate if they think there's anything here that's not accurate.
Any question? Honourable Law.
No, sorry, mine was a procedural suggestion. Okay. I've got questions I want to ask, so if you're going to allow questions, I'll ask my questions.
That's why I asked you, maybe that the author of the paper, maybe they can...
Yeah, give me a department reply to what they said, to be fair, Baba. Then we, you know, the point is that maybe the researchers in good faith have said things there and it's wrong. So, can I throw one question out to you, Commissioner Jacobs? They are arguing that you are much stronger now than you were in the 1990s.
Direct specific questions to
them.
No, but it's just, do they have anything to say, or can we accept that the document is accurate? If we can accept it's accurate, we can then engage with it. If, however, somebody from the police, from the NPA, from the Department of Justice wants to say, no, this point on page 37 and a half is wrong, then let them say it now.
So then let me take Honourable Love, then I'll give over to Department of Justice to just raise some issues on the document, and I'll give over to SAS and raise some issues. issues that have been, that rose from the document, then we'll ask questions.
Chairperson, it seems as if J.J. is, Honorable Jefferson is saying what I wanted to say, because, you see, he has paraphrased the document. Therefore, the people who have done the document should speak to the document now and raise some issues. Because if they say this document is correct, everything is here is correct, then we'll be able to ask questions. Because I want to ask about MCC, the Ministry Coordinating Committee, because it's never done its job and so on and so forth. How can we go back to that and so on? Those are the things that... But we cannot do that before they've finished what they've done. They have to do... Let them respond. Let them respond if there is any response. And then we'll ask them questions.
Then I'll give over to Mr. Daniel.
Thank you, Jane. I think the purpose of part four, the overview of public debate, the whole idea was there to basically just put down what are some of the issues that's been coming up from civil society. And what we did then was to look at newspapers, articles, and whatever. So, as to the veracity, the accuracy of some of those, that was not an issue. The point was merely to raise the issue and say, but there are accusations that the DSO, for instance, is politicized. So, that's one issue that we think that the committee should then deliberate on. As to whether it's true or not and whether it actually happened, I think you're a politician, you should maybe have better insight into what happened.
The report, as I summarized it, do you think it's a reasonably accurate summary? And is there anything you think, but you see, you've not been here, so it's a bit difficult for you. Christine might want to help. Is there anything you think, Christine, in PC, Nadia's been in and out, is there anything you think that I've left out in the summary that will be helpful for you for you to draw to the attention of the committee because of what has emerged in the last 6 weeks or so? Do you think it's a reasonable summary? Okay. In that case, you're saying you acted in good faith, and to the best of your knowledge, what's here is correct. Now, can the departments reply? Is there anything they disagree with, the point JJ is making? Is there anything either of the departments disagree with that is here? They feel it's not really correct. You can just correct it, because the research is acting in good faith. I mean, they did this very fast, Baba. I wrote to them, I think, at the end of March. End of February, I gave you that 10-page thing which I sent to Maggie and said, look, Maggie, I've given them these questions, and I gave it to the study group, so I think she distributed it to you. And you were great. You went far beyond the questions we asked. So,
Chair, now in general, I can agree with that. On the issue about the capacity, I think when you visit the organized crime in Pretoria, they can really expand on what the capacity is. But I from my experience, I really think the capacity and it is something that has grown since compared to commission as well. There's something like 29 plus 4 organized crime units and some restructuring that took place, training on how corruption is being addressed, etc. So I certainly think that statement is correct as it is. As to the specific content, I'm sure the committee will be informed by the organized crime component head as well as the divisional commissioner. Otherwise, in respect of the rest of the document, there are issues that one can maybe take to discuss, like retaining scarce skills. It is true, and I think it's true for the whole of the civil service, retaining skills, but there are programs in place like occupational specific dispensations. There's a scarce skill project in SAPS, etc. But those are things that I think we will interact on. But in general, I think the document as such, and I haven't studied it lengthily, but I see it as a stating research, and there are not really statements here that I can, from our department's view, differ on.
Thanks. Department of Justice, is there anything maybe that you can identify in the document?
Yeah, I must say I haven't studied the document in detail, but in general terms it appears to be in order, and it appears to reflect or gives a picture which we can agree with. You
MCC. Obviously, I was not involved. I'm responsible for legislation. So I was not involved in the functioning of the MCC at all. And it's very difficult for me to comment on, except to say that the findings in the document is in line with some of the findings of the Kampepe Commission, which is also reflected in the document, which I think was also drafted by the researchers, a summary of the Kampepe Commission of Inquiry. If you look at paragraph 5.3.1, you will find the information reflected in the document that was drafted by the researchers in the report of the Kampepe Commission as well.
Thanks.
Chairperson, I also have to say mea culpa like the others, that I have not actually read the document, so I can only really comment on the bits that were highlighted by the chairperson. But there are a couple of points I would just like to highlight. The first one, just at the beginning, it's more a technical point on page 6 when it talks about IDOC. I don't think it's really correct to say that there were sort of sub-directorates of IDOC. IDOC was, there was a single IDOC set up with different focus areas in the different provinces or different cities, but it's not an issue of any substance. But on page 7, when it talks about the prosecution-led investigations in the English legal tradition, I don't think the summary there is very accurate, because in fact the very idea of OSCEO, the Office for Serious Economic Offences, came from the British, from the Serious Fraud Office that was set up in the British and a number of other Commonwealth jurisdictions. So I think that in the Commonwealth tradition itself, there has been a recognition that this traditional model of keeping prosecutors separate from investigators don't always work optimally. So perhaps a little bit more work could be done on that. You know, the South African OSCEO was taken over more or less word for word from the English model. It wasn't a South African innovation at the time. I think there are certainly other models in the world where there are similar ones to the DSO, some of them based even on the DSO model, and we can give that information to the research team as well. Perhaps just, I think it's sort of implicit in the summary on the FBI that the issue of prosecutors and investigators being housed in the same department. But just to be clear, that in the Department of Justice in the U.S., there are prosecutors housed, the whole of the Federal Prosecution Service is housed in the Department of Justice, as is the FBI. So while the FBI is a distinct organization, it is housed in the same department as the whole of the Federal Prosecution Service. And then lastly, just on page 14, and it's, you know, perhaps just a point of clarification that we've made in front of the Justice Committee a few times, is that somehow Treasury in the E&E estimate indicates a target for the DSO's conviction rate to be 95%. And we have over many years indicated to them that that is just not a realistic target in sophisticated cases, but it has remained in the E&E. But internally, the target for the DSO has been 85% rather than 95%, just so one can explain that discrepancy. It's not ever a target that the NPA itself has set in a way. So, Chairperson, I just wanted to make those quick comments. I think we will look through the document, which I agree with others, looks like a really useful summary, and try and look at it in a bit more detail. Thank you.
Thanks. Willie, are there any comments from members? No. Before you, then we can come in.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to find out, you know, from the comparative report, when you look at it, and also when you look at this research, the work that has been done by the research unit, there is this element where they say the MCC, one of the weaknesses is that you see the ministers they were supposed to meet. If there's a lack of coordination there, that has affected the coordination of the officials. Now, I'm drawing this from other committees where we have had a responsibility that is shared within more than one department. Now, I want to find out from, I think, the gentleman who has just answered now, but also maybe to the rest, can't we look at it perhaps further to say comparative, actually, to me, because that seems to be quite part of the crux of the problem, where you have more than one department being responsible for a thing, but now you must bear in mind that first is the political head, then it must have a staffing. And things seem to be falling through in between, you know, to say how best is, can we take one to, the very same task and give it to one department only on behalf of the rest or what? But I'm worried about this, to say from the research point of view, how can this thing be managed, you know, because that when it comes to now, even the act in this age, amendments that we're bringing in, that has to be looked at. So I'm saying if that could be investigated and perhaps if there could be a comment, because that's what I'm also seeing quite correct. Like I'm saying, I can cite other instances where there are these such coordinating structures. There is a problem. You know, I'm just, if you can check that.
Hoping that the question you posed to of Mayor, no, or to Daniel, both of them. Legal advice?
Mine isn't a legal advice, Chairperson, but really just an observation in respect of the role of the prosecutors in the 80s. I did have the benefit of practicing in that very difficult revolutionary time in South Africa. And in fact, what this report doesn't mention was the role of the security police in directing political trials. In fact, very interestingly, at the time we were told by magistrates who were quite enlightened and sympathetic to our cause that they were taken to Durban and shown videos of public violence by the security police. The security police also gave prosecutors instructions. And all of that was designed, in fact, to ensure that people arrested for these political offenses were, in fact, convicted. It's in that sense, Chairperson, that my view, as the Chief State Law Advisor, is that we must tread very carefully and be very cautious about the involvement of the prosecutors in investigations. And I'm not saying there mustn't be prosecution-led investigations to avoid the sorts of abuses that we saw in the 80s when the apartheid regime found itself under extreme pressure politically. Thank you.
Chair, I wanted to be very clear on this matter because, you see, what Mr. Dooley is raising, maybe it's a crux of the matter. Because if the Ministerial Coordination Committee is supposed to sit under justice, does it mean that all other ministers have to come with their budget, have to come with their money to the ministry, or they have to listen to the chairperson of that coordinating committee? Or because the problem I face is that some of these coordination committees don't work because other people come with their mandates and they are being directed and controlled somewhere else instead of being directed and controlled where they're supposed to be. Now, is there any law that anything that prevents the people whom they are being seconded or asked to coordinate to be under the one chairmanship and chairpersonship and work under the chairperson? their mandates, different mandates, and say this, it can't work with us because we're coming from justice. It can't work with us because we're coming from SARS, something like that, which is a different thing. Then you end up having too many slices of cake instead of having a cake in front of you and saying who is going to eat it. That's where the crux of the matter, because if you have a ministerial coordination committee, when there are five ministers coming from different areas and they all come with different mandates, you end up not knowing exactly what you want to do because everybody is coming with his or her mandate. Is there any in law where we say, you come here, we are going to deal with this position, this is the paper that we are going to deal with, you respond to this paper according to your thinking and according to the what you are here for as a government, not because of what your mandate says in justice or in safety and security or whatever. I'm asking those questions to these three departments to tell us so that we are clear on this thing, because the MCC never worked.
Thanks, Honourable Joe. By making an example of a cake, in my language, cake, you can interpret it to many cakes, to many things. Honourable John Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chair. Look, I think the two, I mean, sorry, just one general point on the document. I'm not sure what the policy is within Parliament, but it would be useful for documents to have authors. And I don't see any indication on the document who is involved in drafting it. Maybe it's a policy that documents are just produced by the research section. But I'm talking about names of researchers. Maybe that's the policy, but if it's not the policy, then usually we do see who was involved. But that would be just useful, I think. But anyway, that's a side issue. I think the two issues where, I mean, in spite of Mr. Ndlovu's earlier submission on behalf of the IFP, the early bits that you said in the submission, there's two issues that really are were of concern with the DSO, and which one is trying to address with this legislation, and that's the one is the question of the relationship between the DSO and intelligence gathering. And unfortunately, this document from the research section or from Parliament doesn't really deal with that. There's some reference to it, but not particularly much. And the reason it's of concern is the problem of power, and that a unit that can both institute prosecutions, investigate, and conduct intelligence gathering is immensely powerful. And I think that just really highlighting or reminding that is a major area of concern that's been identified by Parliament as a major area of concern. It's a pity the document doesn't sort of really go into that. I think it's a gap. I think it would be useful if they did. They do briefly touch on it in terms of, I think, the current debate section. The other one then, as I've alluded, is the issue of when we know it's right the way through the role of the prosecutors, and this concept of prosecutorial led, and everybody, well not everybody, but people seem to like that, and it does have its advantages, but at the same time it is then open to abuse. And I think that what's very useful with the document is the references to the fact that in accusatorial system that we fall under, how that is unusual. And even I think within the, I mean, Mr. Hoffmeyer referred to one of the British units, but even with this serious organized crime agency, it seems from what I can gather that there is a effort to separate the investigation from the decision to prosecute. And maybe more research is needed on that angle, not internationally, but in terms of those legal systems falling under the accusatorial system, where you have effectively, theoretically, neutral presiding officers, unlike the European continental inquisitorial system, where the presiding officers actually get involved get more deeply involved. So I think that's quite important. I'm not sure, I mean, maybe again it would be useful to flesh out more exactly what was the role of the prosecutors in the DSO in prosecutions. I mean, you had these DSO people or these NPA people. How much have they effectively prosecuted? Was there a problem or not? How involved were they? Because I think the issue we need to be looking at is a distinction. I mean, the one point that's raised here about the importance, I think it's under the British model, the importance of prosecutors providing comprehensive pre-charge advice to investigators in order to negotiate legal pitfalls, maximize evidential opportunities, etc. I mean, that's fine. Okay. And I don't think anyone can disagree with it. It's a question of advice versus instruction. And I think that's the question, the issue of the difference between prosecutorial led, which is you follow the leader, the leader tells you what to do, versus guidance, where there's at least some separation of you have the investigators investigating, and they then get guidance from the prosecutors, like here, comprehensive pre-charge advice, not instruction, advice. So I think those are the things that we need to also be focusing on. It follows on, I think, Edward Daniels' point of the difficulties that, yes, it might be all very nice to shove them all as they were into one unit, but then you have the potential for problems arising, some of which undeniably have occurred. So I just really wanted to highlight that, and I hope that more focus can also be given on that point. And I think it then boils down to, we need a relationship between this unit and the prosecutors. What should that relationship be? And as I said, I think it's crucial for me, the issue would be more to enable them to guide, to advise, rather than to actually direct. And lead. So I just wanted to highlight those points from the document at this point.
Thanks for the input. Mr. Daniels, is there any response maybe from the inputs that members have made?
Yes, Chair. With regards to the functioning of the Ministerial Coordinating Committee, I will cover that during my presentation of the Compaper Commission.
Mr. Hofmeyr?
Just on the first question that was asked, I think we must all be frank and say that the Ministerial Coordinating Committee never really functioned effectively. And I think that is an issue that must be seriously addressed in whatever new organization is devised. And I think it's important that one must look at structures that are also below a ministerial level, because things cannot be processed. You know, things need to be processed through structures before they get to a ministerial level. And so I think we must build in things from an operational level and an admin level to the ministerial level to ensure that works. I will, I think, talk a little bit more about, when we talk about how the DSO work and it's structured, about the issues that were raised about how involved DSO prosecutors actually are in the cases. So I'll address that issue a little bit more later.
I meant to mention that I think it's sort of relevant at this point on this issue. I mean, I understand within SARS that the people who take the decision, the separation, the people who take the decision that there should be a matter should be investigated, are separated completely from the people actually conducting the investigation. And I think that's, again, a useful safeguard. We may want to look at other sort of entities within our own system, how they operate to try and provide those safeguards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think one of the very specific models that we need to look at in regarding the issue raised by Mr. Jeffrey is the Canadian model. In Canada, there have been at least three commissions of inquiry into what they call miscarriages of justice.
and they looked into the issue of what they call tunnel vision, which can affect investigators, judges, as well as prosecutors. They looked at the issue of using informers which are in prison. And if you look at the prosecution desk book, as they call it, they deal with the special situation of integrated proceeds of crime units. Now, those are units that function on an integrated multidisciplinary fashion. And if I can just read one paragraph here. These units are also a good illustration of the effectiveness of a multidisciplinary approach. To ensure that objectivity and independence is maintained, the ultimate decision to prosecute a given case is taken by the prosecution group head or the regional director. Absent exceptional circumstances, the actual prosecution is carried out by the counsel in the regional office and not by the counsel from that unit. Now, there are prosecutors in those multidisciplinary units, but they're not actually allowed to prosecute, except, as they say, in exceptional circumstances. And even the decision to prosecute is made outside that unit and not by the prosecutors in that unit.
If there are no any comments, inputs, that's from the two briefings that you've received, let us move then to the overview of the Kampepe Commission.
Yeah, but can I just reply quickly to Diane's question? Diane's question, if I understand it, is basically what does the ANC expect would happen in situations where senior political figures are subject to investigation? Well, I think other ANC comrades should come to my aid, right? So I'm offering a tentative reply. So can members just help? As I understand it, the ANC position is no one's above the law. Not even the president of the country or the president of the ANC or whoever. We're very clear, no one's above the law. Secondly, whoever it is who has been involved in organized crime must be investigated by the organized crime unit. It doesn't matter whether you're the president of a country or whether you are an unemployed, marginalized individual with little power. It's the same. I don't think the ANC has any other view. It couldn't. I mean, quite frankly, what else could we believe? No one is saying that the DSO should not investigate politicians, whichever party they come from, if they're involved in organized crime. It is the way this has been done. It has given rise to legitimate perceptions out there, particularly within the ranks of the majority party and its voters and supporters, that senior politicians have been unduly focused on as against other aspects of organized crime and other aspects of the legitimate mandate of the DSO. Now, for example, it's instructive. The DSO, we said in the Justice Committee, when we considered the annual report of the NPA, early part of this year, we said the DSO has brought some of its problems upon itself. And what would the average person conclude other than that the DSO is playing some political role when, for example, it chooses the strangest, the most curious of dates on which to make some of its announcements. For example, on the very eve of the Polokwane Congress conference, it chooses to say, as I remember it, I could be slightly fuzzy about the details, but these are neither here nor there because there's a string of such strange happenings that have led to the perception that the vast majority of the ANC and its supporters and allied supporters have. For example, on the eve of the conference was revealed that there is this case and it is going to be proceeded with, and I think there were further charges attached to it and so on. 3 or 4 days after the Polokwane conference, smack in the middle of the period, I think 27th of December to 1st of or 2nd of January, where it's very unusual, but it's now announced that a further thing is being proceeded with and so on. Moreover, it has taken some 7 years. There has been the case of the former NDPP
having a press conference and declaring that he has a prima facie case. And then there was the briefing with the editors and so on, all of which you're familiar with. It has led to a very legitimate perception out there. But as for whether the DSO should pursue politicians or not, I'm very clear, it should. But for what it's worth, for what it's worth, and I'm not clear about this, I'm told by lawyers and those who know the legal and criminal justice system well, that in certain countries, if there are sensitive cases of presidents or, let's say, senior business people or church leaders or whatever, whether you decide to prosecute or ultimately not is referred to like a senior counsel. My limited understanding in exchanges I've had with these technical experts is that, for example, that would have applied to Star, was it STARR or ST, I don't know, anyway, you might help here. In the case of Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton and the whole impeachment matter, a special independent counsel was appointed to pursue that matter. But in some countries, I think in Britain too, if you pursue a case against a very sensitive figure, a very senior figure, and it could lead to ructions within your society or whatever the criteria is, I'm not sure, then it's an independent counsel that decides on that matter. I'm not saying that's the route we should necessarily go here, but I mean, what I'm trying to say is that there is a legitimate perception out there. And finally, I have suggested as a chairperson, but I'm also speaking as an individual member of this committee, it's just not credible to argue. Willie will not agree, needless to say, or he may agree, but won't be able to say so. It's just not credible to argue that the DSO did not allow itself to be, let's say, the subject of politicization. It's not credible. The issue that we should defer on is the extent to which it happened and the extent to which it accounts for some of the challenges that senior politicians are experiencing. But that it has been acting beyond its mandate is something this very parliament, through the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, decided on. And if I remember, all parties, not least the DA, supported the report of that committee on the Browse-Mole report. So, in short, no, I don't think it's the ANC's view that politicians should not be pursued. But yes, there is a legitimate perception out there that in some cases, certainly, of senior politicians, this has not been handled in a way that's fair and credible. Now, whether that's actually true or not, I don't know, but it's a legitimate perception out there. That's what it's about. But insofar as the answer is, I don't think the ANC believes that anybody's more equal than anybody else. Am I correct? Before Diane wants to respond, we should tie this up because we should look at these things as we proceed with the modelling. But we cannot not answer a question that a member of any member of this committee is asking that derived from a discussion. It's not germane to the report, except insofar as it refers to their observation, the researchers, that there is a perception out there. Now, before we tie this up, does any ANC member want to correct my reflection of the ANC's position? Maybe I've got it wrong somewhere, or maybe I've emphasized one aspect and not another. So I just give our members a chance. Annelies?
Rick, not correct what you say, but I've been thinking myself in this whole process. I've been thinking about, and I agree with you, I think the question is not whether they should or should not be investigated. Parliamentarians, politicians, I think more than anybody else should. But I was thinking, and I know that most probably we won't get the response, an honest response on this, but I believe that if you can imagine yourself that what happened to the president of the ANC happened to an opposition party leader in this country, we would have had a democratic crisis in this country. And it would have been said that we are using the state resources to go after our political opponents. I don't even want a response, but that is something that has been going on in my mind. What would have the reaction have been? And how do we handle, even for future, how do we handle political sensitive cases. And political sensitive cases are not only politicians. Political sensitive cases can also be the head of the Reserve Bank, the senior business people. Exactly. What would have happened if in the United States somebody decided that the head of the FBI should be arrested and prosecuted without informing the political heads or going through a process of what the impact of that would be if it's not managed properly? And I think that is the point that we need to address. And philosophically, I've been asking myself that question. I've been struggling with that issue. What would have happened?
Just to, as a reminder that Helen Ziller was actually arrested and taken to court. So it did happen in a very public way in front of the press and media and cameras, and of course the charges were dropped. So that was a use of the state machinery, as you pointed out, for exactly that purpose by SAS. Just thought I'd remind you there.
I think let's move on. Will you want to come in on that one?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll come back to the chairperson's points, but can I just correct one issue? You will remember that Mr. Zuma had an appeal on the search warrant issues in the Constitutional Court towards the end of December last year. The NPA had to file its replying affidavits in that case on the 14th of December. It was not a date of our choosing. But what seemed or was sometimes reported in the press as a leak or speculation or whatever was simply facts taken from the replying affidavits filed by the NPA on that day. There were no leaks or anything like that. It was simply a court process that happened at a time not of our choosing, and which was not a time we would have chosen to do anything, but unfortunately the deadlines were there. Thank you.
I thought you'd say something. It's not a, you know, there's a string of things that have led to the perception out there. And as we said yesterday, at the end of the day, perception influences politics substantially. And the task becomes that of the DSO to communicate that that's what happened and to explain, which it has never been able to, many, many things about leaks and so on. In this Committee of Justice, we said in reply to Leonard McCarthy and yourself, we do not accept the Justice Committee that you have done enough to contain the leaks. And we agree to disagree. We didn't find the answers credible. The Heffer Commission wasn't convinced. The Compepe Commission also is quite scathing about the leaks. And that commission decided you were not doing enough, etc. So I think there's it out there. I don't think we need to cover the ground again. But the pat answer is no. We don't believe that politicians should not be subject to the same processes and the same laws as any other person. Having said that, Enver, is there anything you want to say in 1 minute about what happens in other societies? Are you familiar, you'll come back to us, on sensitive issues, on sensitive politicians? Is it true that they have like a independent senior counsel in the UK, or they have the system where Monica Lewinsky, Clinton were dealt with, also had something like that? They don't just leave it to your equivalent of your investigative authorities or prosecuting authorities.
I must confess that in the Monica Lewinsky matter, I'm more familiar with the salacious details as publicized. But on a more serious note, well, I was intrigued by the many uses you could have.
People may pretend on the opposite benches as they drink now, but they probably know more about the salacious details than you do, but now they're suggesting otherwise.
I am certain. But the interesting thing for me about Special Prosecutor Starr is this. Special Prosecutor Starr, if my memory serves me correctly, was in fact appointed by Congress to do an independent investigation into the matter, because Congress had to consider an impeachment application. And for that purpose, it needed information, it needed to make a decision, and so Starr was appointed to uncover what had actually happened in the West Wing. And that was very interesting. Let me suggest to this committee chairperson that Parliament has similar powers.
Parliament, in terms of its oversight, can hold a full inquiry and a full investigation and summons people. I'm not aware, and I may be wrong, and I have watched Parliament very closely, that those powers of Parliament have actually been used to its fullest since 1994. Thank you, Chairperson.
I think let's take an overview of the campus commission. It's over to you.
How much time do I have?
Sorry?
How much time do I have?
I'm giving you up to 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. The campus commission is around 150 pages, 58 pages. We've handed a summary of the campus commission, about 15 pages. And then there's also the PowerPoint presentation that I'm going to do now, hand it out to members.
Yeah.
Members will know that on 1st April 2005, Judge C.C. Kempepe was appointed chairperson of the commission. And they issued two interim reports, first on 21st of July 2005 and later on 24th January 2006. And then the final report is then dated 3rd of February 2006. If one looks at the structure of the Campaign Commission, one will find there's an executive summary introduction, and then approaches as to how they derived at the findings, and then the different references, the approach they adopted. And then the main focus of the report is the 13 terms of references. You'll note there the title and then the evidence that was left, the findings, recommendations, and then a conclusion. This presentation will focus mostly on the compendium of findings as well as the compendium of recommendations of the KPP Commission. On 6th May 2005, an invitation was extended to various entities. Those included government institutions, departments, academic institutions, and they were requested then to submit affidavits with regards to the different, the 13 different terms of reference. Around 30 submissions were received, and they also then went on site visits here and abroad, and those included visits to the FBI in the USA, SOCA, CIA's Organized Crime Agency in the UK, as well as Scotland Yard. If one looks at the 13 different terms of references, see there's the first seven. I'm not going to read the first 17 months. Is available to members. There's the terms of reference from 8 to 13. And if I can then start with the first terms of reference, I'll firstly just cover briefly the findings, and then I will note what was the specific recommendation with regard to the terms of reference. With regard to the rationale behind the establishment of the DSO, you note there that the judge found that despite the drop in crime, there was still a requirement for comprehensive strategy to address organized crime. And she was not persuaded that the rationale for the establishment of DSO disappeared. She believed that there was still a place for the DSO. The recommendation then that was made with regard to this specific term of reference was that despite indications that organized crime was being addressed and there was a drop in crime levels, the rationale for the establishment of DSO remained as valid, you know, as at its conception. The second terms of reference relates to the legislative mandate of the DSO. And you'll note there, the last two bullets, that the judge was satisfied that there's nothing unconstitutional that the DSO actually say a mandate with the South African Police Service, and also nothing unconstitutional in having a structure such as DSO located with the NPA. Remember, there was debate with regards to a single police force, debate as to whether they have the legislative competence to investigate as well as prosecute matters. And it does found that those were without merit.
If one I just draw Peter's attention to the fact that tone is important, eh? The way you say something, tone is important. You seem very enthusiastic about this point. Teasing you, man.
I
if one looks at the recommendation with regards to the second term of reference, so note there that the judge ruled that it was permissible to have the DSO share the mandate to tackle organized crime with the South African Police Service, and then he said that was recommended that these tensions that were there between the police and the DSO can actually be addressed by establishing a specific structure. And later on I'll refer to this again, but it deals with multidisciplinary vetting structures. And that structure was supposed to be composed of SOCs, or officials of the police service. For instance, the national commissioner should be there, the DGs of SAS and NIA, representatives of the SNDF, as well as correctional services, representatives of civil society. So that was the recommendation made with regard to legislative mandate of the DSO. If one looks at the third terms of reference, regarding the evaluation of implementation of this legislative mandate of DSO, the first finding there was that the Ministerial Coordinating Committee did not properly discharge its responsibility under the Act. There were difficulties of law enforcement agency may have been averted if the policies and procedures been in place in terms of Section 31 of the NPA Act. Another point made was that the criticism level at the DSO cannot be shut up easily. And this relates to the leaking of information to the media, as well as the unfair advantage of case selection for investigation, and this caused conflict and tension between the DSO and the SAS. And she found that the judge found that the structure of the MCC was inadequate to fully address daily operational difficulties that may arise. There one can note what was the recommendation. Firstly, it was that besides the MCC, there needs to be another structure. And this is the structure I was referring to, the multidisciplinary military structure. They should actually deal with the day-to-day issues of the DSO. Another important point there to note was that DSO was not under the jurisdiction of the Independent Complaints Directorate, and the recommendation is then made that they should fall under the ICD. System for the management and control of DSO. There's one of the contentious points is that the National Director of Public Prosecution did not comply with Section 19B of the NPA Act, and that deals with security screening, the vetting of the people that are involved in these processes. And she found that it was actually an unacceptable practice, because this can actually undermine the security of the state. And then also, she said there was evidence that there's actually liaison with foreign law enforcement agencies, as well as intelligence agencies. And this actually illustrates the dangers of not having everybody going through the security screening process. Recommendation, firstly, is that this competence needed to be exercised within the parameters of the law. So this is actually adhere to Section 19B. And then recommend that immediate steps should be taken to comply with the specific section of the NPA Act. In terms of reference 5, systems for communication of the DSO, there is a problem with regard to public complaints, the leak of information. It has actually caused embarrassment and prejudice to the accused, and he found that this conduct was actually reprehensible, unprofessional, and was corroding public confidence. The recommendation with regard to this is that DSO needed to work within the legal parameters, and then if this multidisciplinary vetting structure is created, they will actually assist the DSO to address this issue. Remember, this also dealt with every person's right to a fair trial with regard to the Bill of Rights, and if these leaks are then made, then this must can actually prejudice the accused. Oversight and accountability in respect of intelligence and related operations of the DSO. Firstly, it says there that in terms of Section 7.1 of the NPA Act, the DSO has an information gathering mandate. But there was evidence that they were actually involved with intelligence gathering. And if this is the case, it says that they have then gathered gathered this intelligence unlawfully. Recommendation? Firstly, he said that this issue should be addressed by resolving this political disjuncture. And this political disjuncture deals with the different ministers, the Minister of Safety and Security and the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. He says here, the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development performs this function as a responsible political head under which the administration of the NPA Act falls. He does not, however, have practical, effective political oversight responsibility in respect of the law enforcement element of the work of the DCO. The minister who decides final responsibility for law enforcement is the Minister of Safety and Security. He does not have political oversight responsibility in respect of the investigative element of the work of the DSO. And therefore it was then recommended that the President should actually use the powers invested in transfer or to vest some of these functions or authority in the different ministers. The constitutional and legislative mandate of the African Police Service, there was a problem with regard to whether it's only the police that have exclusive jurisdiction with regard to crime in this country, and the judge couldn't agree with that. He said there's nothing legally unsound in conferring this mandate on the DSO as well, because there are other institutions in the country that also have similar powers. And then there's the recommendation. He said also permissible to have the DSO share the mandate to tackle organized crime with SAPS. And then lastly, if we resolve detention between our mandate with the multi-disciplinary vetting structure at the appropriate levels of authority, then we will have a much better operation there. Remember I said earlier that this structure, that this substructure that is proposed is basically top officials of the various departments, you know, headed by the National Commissioner, the DSO involved there, the National Defense Force, Correctional Services, as well as the DGs of NIA and SES. Systems for coordination and cooperation between SAPS and the Intelligence Agency and the DSO. We found that there was no system to coordinate the cooperation between these two entities. But if you go lower down, you will find that at with regards to training exercises, there were some cooperation, as well as in some provinces, there were cooperation between these two institutions. Important there is that prior to the DSO being invited to the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee, there was no coordination. When they were invited, then it went to the better. And there's the recommendation, and that is that the DSO should be placed in permanent status with NICOC. And then lastly, also that the creation of this MVS would also offer a useful platform for the coordination cooperation between the various structures. The effectiveness and efficiency of coordination of intelligence. There he found that the coordination of crime intelligence rests with the crime intelligence division of SAPS. And then in terms of the National Strategic Intelligence Act provisions, the DSO were not empowered to gather crime intelligence. And they were actually supposed to use existing intelligence structures, you know, for intelligence purposes. And then the recommendation was that because they are now involved or have status with NICOC, you know, this will be addressed and they should actually then be formally be part of NICOC. The efficacy of coordinating systems that exist between intelligence agencies. Here they look at issues such as the rationalization of resources and minimizing undue duplication. They just found that here you actually need somebody with expert knowledge and understanding, and she didn't fully comply with this specific terms of reference. She said that the services of an expert should actually be engaged to address this specific issue. If you look at terms of reference 11, training or further training on policing or investigative methods, say there that collective responsibility on all law enforcement agencies to make South Africa safe. And because there's no system of cooperation and coordination between SAPS and the DSO regarding their shared training in investigating and combating organized crime, this is a problem because everybody, all law enforcement agencies, should be involved in this process. And then she recommended there that the DSO and SAPS should actually streamline the training to achieve greater efficiencies. The impact of locating investigators and prosecutors within the NPA. Firstly, she found that this structure is not unique in the world. Reference was made to this before. Secondly, that there is no legal impediment of such a structure within a prosecuting authority provided its dependence is safeguarded, something Mr. Karim referred to earlier. But the problem here is with the involvement of the prosecutor in investing this case. And it deals here with embeddedness of the prosecutor, which brings the challenge of neutrality to the fore. And also that he will have to make the information available to the accused person. And then very important is the integrity of the prosecutor, because remember the prosecutor is then also a servant of the court, and he should make all the information available to him also available to the court. And he just found that the integrity of prosecutors, of individual prosecutors, should be of cardinal importance when one is appointing or scrutinizing appointment. And there you can see the findings. They recommend that the various disciplines within the DSO must remain under a single command structure. And then secondly, she found that she was satisfied that the practice of housing multiple disciplines under one command is a sound practice. Remember, here she's talking about a Troika principle where we have the prosecutors, the investigators, as well as the crime analysts working together on a specific case. And she lastly just said that if they then work together like this, it will actually enhance closer cooperation between the different disciplines, and then they can benefit from each other. With regard to the location of the DSO, she found that there was always a need for a coherent, effective strategy to fight organized crime. Remember, there were arguments, especially from the police side, that firstly, there was a decline in crime. Secondly, that the DSO was actually supposed to be a temporary structure. And further, that while the SAPS was being transformed, okay, then the DSO could actually operate, but once they transformed the SAPS, and then they could disband the DSO. And you could see there that the judge didn't find any evidence of this. But a main problem, the problem still remains that government was concerned about the capacity of SAPS to deal with organized crime. Remember, there were a lot of accusations that the previous police force, you know, there were a lot of political agendas, etc. But also, there was the killing of certain police investigators. There was the low conviction rate of some of these cases. And the judge couldn't agree with some of these things, some of the arguments that was made by the African police. As I say, the drop in crime level is not enough to justify the translocation of the DSO to South African police service. But more importantly, the last bullet point is that despite this unhappy relationship between the DSO and SAP, you know, it was actually imperative that they all should work together and cooperate, you know, and coordinate their activities to actually together fight crime. Okay, they must cooperate, and it actually refers to the constitutional imperative that they should cooperate. And there, one can see the recommendations. Firstly, she says because the DSO was prosecution-led, its concomitant location could only be with the prosecuting authority. So that was the argument of the commission then, because of this focus on prosecution. You know, the DSO should actually be located within the NPA and then subsequently in the DSO. And then lastly, she just says it's a considered view that DSO should continue to will be located within the National Prosecuting Authority. There were a further few other issues that she covered, and the first one deals with Circular 1, something that Mr. Unikarim has also referred to. This has also been a bone of contention, because what happened here was the police and even DIA accused the DSO of unilaterally drafting the circular. And this circular is basically a sort of operation manual, you know, how they decide on cases, you know, the issues, the criteria that they are used. And there was a strong feeling that they should actually have involved other agencies, law-fighting agencies, in this process. As I say, this was one of the main reasons for tension with the South African Police Service. I referred to this earlier, it's with regards to cooperative governance. It says the Constitution enjoins the structures to cooperate in mutual trust and good faith, and the lack of cooperation between SAS and DSO is partly due to the MCC not functioning properly. Remember this whole issue of turf battles? And then lastly, it just says that the primary function of the executive is to implement legislation and to see to Section 31 of the Competitive Commission is actually adhered, and that basically deals with cooperation and coordination. One of the last issues there that he referred to is the DSO's methodology. What he then did was to compare the Troika methodology or approach with the traditional method, and he found that at that stage, when the Commission was concluding, that there was a conviction rate of over 90%. And to her mind, this was actually a testimony to the effectiveness of the DSO. Secondly, there was also no reason why the skill base of the DSO should not be extended to the organized crime unit of the South African Police Service. Remember, earlier we talked about training. There, the suggestion was also that because DSO has this skill for the training and the training facility, they should actually share it with other law enforcement agencies and not just keep it to themselves. And lastly, she was of the firm view that the MPA is duty-bound to provide adequate prosecutorial services to the South African Police Service. And then in conclusion, sir, ma'am, the question for effective and efficient strategy to tackle organized crime runs like a golden thread through the whole issue of the crime justice system, and then the importance of coordination and cooperation is emphasized, and the imperfections in relationships gave rise to the establishment of the Competitive Commission, and that it's also very necessary to have an ongoing review of what's happening within this law fighting processes to manage the constant challenges. And then she says lastly that the threat of organized crime presents a formidable challenge that will continually require creative and determined strategies to deal with it. That's my story.
Thank you. This is all very well. But can I ask you a more fundamental question? When you think this incessant rain is going to stop? When you think this incessant rain is going to stop? You're a researcher, help us. While I'm talking about the rain, I need to tell the Safety and Security Committee that in justice what we do, where we have very contested legislation and where we can't find each other, we go off often to Mauritius or somewhere nice along the coast. Mauritius. Or Seychelles or Comores, somewhere very nice. And we have a chalet, a big chalet, all of us. Dan, you'll be horrified to know you'll have to be under the same roof as me and JJ and so on. And that's going to happen. And you'll suddenly feel all the tension oozing out. And we'll have finished the bill in 2-3 hours so we can go and frolic on the beach and so on. I really think this is the way to solve all our tensions. Can the journalist write a piece on this, please? Because this is the most newsworthy thing today. That's the public out there would be interested in. Okay, having said that, can I just say on a more serious note, which is very hard for me to summon this very morning. Peter, I really think you'll have done us very good and done your unit proud. Firstly, there's a 15-page summary.
that I think members have got, 30th of July 2008. I would urge members to look at. I must confess I haven't read it too, but I'll read it tonight. But secondly, can I also say that members have been given a copy of the full commission report when we had the first day of the public hearings or thereabouts. Thirdly, this is a very astute summary, I must say. Very nicely done. And once again, I think the research unit, we must congratulate them for the good work they've been doing. And also, Pete in particular, I know you've been not well. And we've waited with bated breath for you to come. It's been worth it. And we wish you well for a full recovery. Having said that, questions, please. It's raining, so I don't think we should actually leave this parliament tonight into tomorrow until the rain stops. And maybe we should start next week's proceedings this week. JJ? Oh, sorry. Okay. Right. JJ and your friend Diane after that, and Len. Okay. He's being chivalrous and sexist, because, I mean, why? Because she's a female. But anyway, let's not discuss that, Diane.
You obviously have a lot of these problems in your ranks. Look, as far as I can see, virtually all of the issues raised over and over during the various hearings have in fact been dealt with and answered within this report. Thank you. I think this document is excellent, a real great summary of a huge document. And we've heard Mr. Hofmeyr say, in effect, answer various of the issues as we've been talking over the last days, saying that, look, there have been no press leaks for years, and yes, there was one unvetted computer expert, but he was under guard, taken in, taken out. Now, the void left by this ministerial coordinating committee seems to be at the very crux of this entire issue. In fact, look, the judge's ruling, which was sadly kept out of the public eye for so very long, a move which really, I must contend, led directly to the negative perception that you keep referring to, Chair. This document really has led me to the point where I must ask you if the members of the Ministerial Coordinating Committee could not be brought here to answer to us for absolute dereliction of duty. It is that body that has led us, according to the judge's learned document, that they have led us to this very point sitting in this room today. If they had just taken their own job and done it, we could have avoided this entire debacle. And I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on that. Thank you.
Len, JJ.
Thank you, Chair. My question is to the law drafters. I want to know to what extent, if any, this report was used when they drafted the new bills.
The recommendation about the political oversight and responsibility for the law enforcement component of the DSO going to the Minister for Safety and Security. I don't know if you can. I wasn't concentrating throughout. Can you just take that section, please? Sorry. Yes. Can you just take us to that section? Okay. No, I've got the thing. Okay. Now, what my question is how would that work in? How would that work in practice? Are you listening or not?
Serving us, and now you want to ask the same question that he answered, but go ahead.
How would that work in practice? I think it's a crucial thing. I mean, I know the commission made recommendations about
the press. That I'm fair. I'm trying to impress the press. I've been needling Diane all morning. Now I'm needling JJ. Can you note that, please?
Len says he wants to be needled. But the point I'm making is the commission sort of said, okay, it could be done by way of the president assigning responsibilities. But in practice, okay, in terms of parliamentary accountability, in terms of budgets, in terms of those kinds of responsibilities, how would that work? She did not flesh that out.
Okay.
I just want a clarity on MVS. What is that? Is it? It is multi? Can be confused with something else, because if it's written like this, it means totally different thing with what we are being saying now. That is why I wanted to get it clear what it's all about.
I didn't read this 15-page report, but I'll speak to your leader about that. Okay, anything else? No? Good. Over to you, Peter.
With regard to the first question, I think it was more of a suggestion or comment than anything else. The press leaks and debacle around the ministerial coordinating committee. But in part, ma'am, I can also answer the question and other questions subsequent to this. Is I think the idea of the multidisciplinary vetting structure is a very good one. In the sense that below the MCC, because remember there's no suggestion to do away with the MCC. I think it should still be there, and that was what the commission said. But below that, you should have a sort of substructure, administrative, managerial, consisting of top officials that can actually advise the MCC. But because they never said, this was never called into life, and I'm not sure whether this was even brought up. I don't think it was ever established. But if you have this kind of structure, it will help to sort of firstly channel the different cases, because remember the accusation of cherry-picking cases, and cases that have got a good chance of conviction. So they will then channel these to the MCC, and they will decide which organization should actually deal with it. So this proposal, to my mind, is a very solid one, and I think going forward, this may be something that you seriously be concerned.
Did I hear you correctly when you say?
Through Jefferson, I'm sorry. I'm not jumping on him. Did I hear correctly when you say channel the cases to the MCC? Did you say that, or was that
what
saying?
What I was
channel cases to MCC or channel cases to?
What I was trying to say, sir, is that if you look at the DSO and how it operated, it was supposed to fall under the Ministerial Coordinating Committee, that consisting of various ministers, and they were supposed to prevent duplication and to prevent some of this coordination, cooperation, conflict, and tension that eventually came to manifest. And below the MCC is this multi-vetting structure, and the idea was that if there are cases, these cases first serve before the MVC, the multi-disciplinary vetting structure, and they will then decide in which ambit is it best to place a specific case. So whether it goes to the DSO, the AFU, or whether it goes to the OCU, they will then decide. So I mean, channeling in that sense. Don't know whether
other follow-ups?
No.
Can I say quick things? One is, you know, you just said in your earlier paper. Yeah. Oh, yes, of course, sorry.
Maybe you can't answer, but...
I think it's a very good question indeed, but at the end of the day, I'm not sure how the process is going to work if we have the two ministers and then the functions in terms of what the judge has recommended. You know, law enforcing strictly with the Minister of Safety and Security, and then prosecution strictly with the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. I'm not sure how the process is going to work budgetary wise and parliamentary wise, how that is going to be.
I mean, I think that's the sort of nub of the point. How would it work? Is it actually practical? Because if you have political responsibility, that needs to follow budgetary responsibility. And how the money is spent. And is it, I mean, so I don't know if it's fair to put the question now, but maybe something for Parliament, because it's ultimately a parliamentary issue. Was that recommendation actually implementable?
Come in, Julie.
actually from Pietermaritzburg, yeah.
I know this young man always do these things to me. No, Chair. The most important part is that how did it work before in the Troika? Was the DSO, so-called DSO, was it under Justice and Constitutional Development? And who paid the investigators at that time?
Justice.
You see? Now, if you transfer that to the SAPS, do you mean the same thing with the prosecutors to SAPS? I think that's what JJ is asking. Now, I'm asking the same question, that if you come with all your rights from this side, to transfer from this side to this side, then you say, this is my mandate, whose mandate is really superior to the other mandate? That will be the crux of the matter, because if we talk about prosecutor-led investigation, where does it come from, and who led it, and who pays what at the end of the day?
The way this can be seeped into the discussion next week, it's about modeling. We have to think through even secondments. How do we do it? Where does the budget come from? And so on. So in a way, JJ's question is really a question not to you, Peter, but unfair. It's a question for us all to mull over. But I think Kampepe might have meant, I don't know, I can't speak for her, that it would be a single budget, but political accountability will be to different ministers. Yes, JJ?
The point I'm making is that the point is raised the whole time. We shouldn't be dealing with this legislation. It's unnecessary. That's all she said. What I'm trying to figure out is what she recommended isn't actually implementable practically.
Yeah.
How can you make somebody politically, you have this unit to the DSO, you have then police investigators. She says give the political responsibility for those investigators to the Minister of Safety and Security. But how? Okay, if you keep them within this DSO, which is under the justice budget, how does the Minister of Safety and Security...
Question to those who support this idea. You know, does anybody want to comment? I'm looking particularly
maybe
in one direction.
I mean, look, Mr. Ndlovu himself said, where's the submission? He said, somebody got the IC submission, but the stuff earlier on. Okay, so maybe you could ask Mr. Ndlovu. That the decision to disband reeks of political self-protection. It's irrational and will not advance the fight against organized crime. So you want us to keep the DSO as it is. Can you then tell us, how do we implement Judge Kampepe's recommendation around giving political responsibility to the Minister of Safety and Security? Maybe Ms. Kolobana...
Question to all the opposition members, because they're very keen on the bill. But can we, before you reply, can we just take a question from Bulelani related to this matter?
It's a comment from what the Honourable Jeffrey has said. Is that I think what we also need to consider is that constitutionality on its own cannot be the only criteria. The fact that the DSO is constitutional, that Kampepe said is constitutional, cannot be the only criteria. You must also take into consideration what Honourable John Jeffries has just said. You must also take into consideration the issue of effectiveness and efficiencies. There's a lot of criteria that you must also be taken into consideration. So we can't use the issue of constitutionality as the only criteria why we must keep the scorpions.
Okay, over to you, Baba.
Jefferson, when I hear legislators, we deal with the matters of operation, sometimes we deal with the policies. I said when I presented my paper, it was a policy position. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty of how this thing to be done, it will be dealt with when we deal with the chapter and verse of the bill. But I'm asking the question, if the DSO was under the Justice and Constitutional Development and everything was paid there, the whole budget and so on, and now they say the political head should be the safety and security. Where is the problem? If the problem is because of the safety and security, does you say that the DSO, the prosecutors must be separated, or they must be separated from the investigators? What do you mean by that? Is it an amendment, or is it a new thing, or what? Because it's not for me to say so. Because if I can say what I want to say, and then you all agree with me, then we won't be sitting for more than 5 days here. We'll sit only half a day and then we leave, because nothing will be changed. But now, because we are debating the issue, all of us have to think about it. This is why I'm putting on the table. Where do you locate this thing? And how do you locate it?
I'm on an endless discussion here.
I just wanted to point out to Mr. Ndlovu that the bill as it stands deals with the problem that was identified by the judge by putting the investigators under the police and having the prosecutors removed entirely. And what we're looking at is that the relationship between the two. But there won't be any problem in terms of the accountability, in terms of the bill as it is. You won't have those problems. But this is the bill that you're opposing as the IFP, that you say is irrational and everything else. So that's what, how the bill addresses the problem that the judge identified. Now, I'm wanting to know, you want to keep the DSO legislation. To you and to Mr. Joubert and Ms. Kohler-Barnard, how are you going to actually institutionalize this recommendation to ensure proper accountability to Parliament, budgetary and everything else? Can you please tell us?
That is a fair question. Come, Diane, Lynn. Do you want to reply?
Yeah.
Chief, first of all, when we say we want to keep the scorpions as they are, we did not say we want to implement everything in the Kapepe report. So surely those things can be accommodated somewhere else as well.
Do I understand the DA position then that they disagree with that recommendation by Judge Khampepe, that the accountability for the police members must go to the Minister of Safety and Security? Because that's what I understand Mr. Joubert to be saying. No, Mr. Joubert, not Mr. Ndlovu, or Mr. Joubert.
Thank you. I think that's simplifying the matter. I think the main thrust of our presentation is that this unit has got to be kept out from underneath the SAPS as an individual separate entity. Now, if you take the investigators, that unit, and you put it under SAPS. Again, the influence is you have nobody to investigate SAPS because it's SAPS investigating itself. That is as clear as day. You have got to keep a unit that is separate. Indeed, it's been explained by Mr. Hoffmeyer that when they've had the odd investigation in their unit, they call in members of SAPS to assist in the investigation and other entities. Now, if you remove the one and only independent investigative organization and you push those investigators under SAPS, there is no one left to investigate the next celebi. It will be quashed. There is no doubt in my mind.
Chair, look, with respect, I won't talk again. The question is that the DA would now want to keep the DSO as it is for the reasons that Ms. Kohler-Barnard mentioned. Okay? So my question is, keeping it as it is, how do you implement Judge Khampepe's recommendation of transferring politically accountability or responsibility for the SAPS members to the Minister of Safety and Security?
Baba's consistently having an identity crisis. Now he thought he was Lynn earlier, now he thinks he's Diane. So, okay, Baba, speak.
I thought he was asking two of us, because you can't ask yourself, because he knows that where do you stand on the position. He was just asking us.
No.
Can I suggest you are more nuanced than the DA is? And so the question is correctly posed to them in particular. Right, but we're coming to you in a moment. Let's just finish this thing, but you must move on. We've got 15 minutes before lunch. Yeah, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. I have absolutely, and we have absolutely, no problem with the joint reporting lines, as they should have been, and as this should have been handled by the Ministerial Coordinating Committee, which would have clarified the entire issue, the defunct, non-existent committee. So that could work, but to actually have the day-to-day accountability and day-to-day workings of the investigators within the SAPS is problematic for us. It's got to be kept as a separate entity to ensure that we have accountability on both sides. I mean, the very fact that we have
we've seen a turnaround of the DSO literally in the last 2 to 3, I think, years now. You have at the end of Advocate Jacob's submission a clipping from the Pretoria News, and it says that Advocate Leonard McCarthy says he was underplaying the unit, the successes weren't what they said. Willie Hoffmeyer says actually it's up to 91.4, whatever he said yesterday, percent success rate. There are issues that still have to be discussed and dug out and gone over. But as far as keeping this unit separate so that they have the ability to investigate SAPs and other high and mighties, we're not budging on that.
I wouldn't speak again, but my problem is we're not talking about that issue. That's a side issue that she's trying to bring in. The issue is basically, how do you have political responsibility
not the budget.
Without
budget. You're not answering that question. Yes. To be fair, answer that question precisely, Diane, or say you'll come back to us on Tuesday next. But it's a fair question. How do you have political accountability without the appropriate budget allocation?
We already have the budgetary allocation. We have budgetary allocation for oversight of the unit, which has not been done, as admitted by the current chair. So presumably, if safety and security were handling a certain amount of the oversight only of the investigators, as is your proposal, we would have sufficient budget because they would now not be having oversight over that particular unit. The money is there already. It just would be divided slightly differently, according to...
In other words, if I understand you correctly, what you're...
Chair, you want a specific answer. I can give you my personal view, but the party as such has not taken a view on that particular point. My personal view was, and I tried to say that when I answered originally, is that I don't think all the recommendations of the yes. So, and that is one that certainly has a problem.
What Diane seems to be saying, if I understand her, right, let's see if we do. And really, we're not going to spend endless hours trying to interpret somebody who can speak very freely for herself. Now, it's this. I think what you're saying, Diane, is it doesn't matter. The budget can remain in one. In the case of the Kampepe Commission, presumably you would argue the budget should remain with the Department of Justice. But accountability can occur of the investigators to the SAPS. So you do not accept the view that accountability is related to budget allocation necessary in all situations. Len says, look, your party will apply its mind and suggest that it's not workable, because I think underpinning what he's saying is that what Jay is saying, that actually accountability goes with the budget, which is normally the norm in our parliament and most, but let's agree that for now that's as far as we can take it. I see a lot of hands shooting up there, but before we do, let's give Baba and Glovo a chance.
No, I think, Jefferson, if JJ, the Honorable Jeffrey, why should I call him Honorable? Oh, JJ.
Why him in particular? Good point. That's the best point you made today.
If JJ can read the first paragraph, independence, that's where the answer is. Where I say it should not report to the National Commission of the Police, but should report directly to the Minister of Justice. The Minister will be accountable to Parliament of the Unit, budget and administration, but not to be allowed to be directly involved in the investigation. Why I'm saying, don't jump on me, I'm older than you. Why I'm saying that, Jefferson, is that when we're dealing with a budget, it's a different matter than a command and control. It's a different matter. Then we are talking about the government here. We're not talking about one person who's coming from his house and then do whatever he wants to do. We're talking about a budget here.
No, JJ.
Please, just because it's
okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely last.
Last point, okay. Now, the IFP submission was first point. Don't disband the Scorpions or don't move the Scorpions. It's irrational. Political self-protection won't advance the fight against crime. That's the first point. Second point is then, if you move them, then there must be independence. So Mr. Ndlovu's point is that he's raised is regarding the second point. Accepting that they're moved, then they must report to the Minister of Safety and Security. But that's not what the IFP want as their first point. Their first point is don't do anything with them. That's why my question is, okay, because now he's supporting the moving to Safety and Security.
No.
That's why my question is...
So option three.
No.
And option two, which is... an independent unit alongside the SAPS.
May I respond?
Under the police budget. You want
may I respond?
says, yes.
Behaving like a typical politician.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is a real politician, but it's not schooled one. Not schooled one. However, it is clear that the IFP, that the majority party will force its own will on the public, notwithstanding the outcry. That's the answer that I'm giving him. Therefore, whatever question that he asks, at the end of the day, if they do that, then this is what we should be proposing. But if they don't do that and they listen to the outcry of the people, that's exactly what is intended.
Okay, can I suggest that both of you come from Umsunduzi, in a manner I'm speaking in the case of the one. This weekend, why don't you all forego your families and so on and discuss this matter and report back to us next Tuesday. Those of you who've got your hands up, unless you see something earth-shattering in you, I'm going to rule you out of order. Right. Now, Annelies had hand up, Bulalani had hand up, this cabal there, the four of them, who are sharing chewing gum or gums or whatever, only amongst the four of them. Vanara, can you check the rules of parliament? Can a chair prescribe where people sit, especially of the party he or she comes from? Because they've been highly disruptive and asking questions they wouldn't have otherwise asked if they weren't chopping away at their chewing gum or whatever it is, so they can't hear poor Peter Daniels because the noise of their masticating their gum, which they haven't shared with the rest of us, there's no Ubuntu there. I mean, really, the two chairs in particular are under enormous stress. If you have Diet Cola Banan in your committee, you are highly stressed. In fact, Parliament, Banara, can you check the rules? Chairs that have to deal with the Diet Cola Banan of this world, shouldn't we get a higher fee for stress levels?
Danger pay.
Danger pay. Okay, can we come back now to the three hands that went up? Great. Okay, now it gives the chair or co-chair an opportunity to consume the entire 7 minutes. Okay, one. Very quickly, Peter, no long speeches, but I want to make some observations. If you don't reply, it's fine. Right. No. Quickly, the chair was supposed to have gone for 1 minute and she took 25 minutes, but we'll talk about that later. Is the DSO so unique? Actually, the Kampepe Commission says it's not unique. Your report says it is. There's a difference, right? Point two. It's interesting, the observation of the Kampepe Commission, that people feel that Circular 1 actually made their case, that the DSO is a law unto itself. But the DSO will argue, consistent with your report, that precisely because the MCC failed, they had no choice, they had to do their own circular, which I think is probably substantially true, but I don't know enough. Thirdly, on this issue of the role and responsibility of the MCC for where we are at the moment, I think there's relative consensus that the MCC failed dismally. And in some measure, if not in good measure, some at least, of the challenges we have currently lay fairly and squarely on the shoulders of this MCC and its particular failure to act, even after the Kampepe Commission, which surely the executive members were privy to, was given to Cabinet. Now, Diane raises a correct point. Shouldn't Parliament haul the ministers before us and ask them to account? It seems to me, we can mull over this, we don't have to take a decision now. It would not be appropriate for the following reasons. One, Parliament could not have played that oversight role of the MCC to the level we could have if the report was released 2 years ago. And it befuddles me why the report was not released. I thought it contained some very sensitive information. But if this is a full report, as I understand it to be, I haven't read it, I must confess, but the summaries are quite erudite, Peter, and others have read it here. I don't know why it wasn't released. But if it was released, then the injunction or the compulsion on Parliament to have monitored it would have been greater. Okay? Now, having said that, given where we are, and given that we're moving strongly in the direction, whatever decisions they want, models, even if we stick with the DSO model, we want very explicit and precise provisions for this committee to meet. Bulalani and others suggesting not just, and Pete himself, not just that political committee, but overall coordinating committee of officials to ensure it works. Given all of that, what would be the purpose to call the ministers here? And maybe what we can do is when we end next Thursday, we can even call them to a closed committee meeting. And then we report back to the committee if people think that. So can we leave that in abeyance? Christine in BC, note this thing, whether we want to proceed in the direction Diane is saying. But we must also accept, the Justice Committee in particular,
Even if we didn't know what Kompepe had said, surely, we knew enough to know what's in the NPA Act to act, and we must take co-responsibility. It's not enough to whinge and whine about the executive. Half the problem is Parliament consistently failing to do what we're supposed to do. So, hey, you know, we can criticize the ministers, but we have the power to have called them here, and we didn't. And we didn't need the Kompepe Commission to do it, though I insist, if we had the Kompepe Commission, it would have been easier to do it. So, on the practical issue of whether we call them here or not, let's leave that in abeyance, is my suggestion. And, Lolly, you also come back to us, committee secretaries, I mean, to monitor what chairs say and do and what committees decide on. But it also seems to me we might want to call the ministers here for another reason. To find out why it didn't work, so as to influence the shaping of the crafting of the legislation. Maybe there are legitimate reasons why it couldn't meet. I find that difficult to accept, but maybe there are. And that will influence what we craft in the legislation. So it's not so much to call them here and repeat what we've said, because they'll give us no credible reason why they didn't act even remotely, consistent with what they should have done in terms of both the law and Kompepe. Did you use this report for the bill, Mr. Commissioner? Answer Mr. Len Jobert's question.
Chair, I'll refrain myself from just saying yes, we have used the... I'll refrain myself from saying that we... Just to say yes on the question that we have looked at the report in drafting.
You're a comrade of the ANC and you implemented Polokwane unconditionally, in other words. By the way, that's a facetious remark. It was really a joke. You have to have a sense of humor if you're sitting here cheering endlessly and saying the same things roundabout. And really, there's no special fee when we have difficult opposition members. So please, that's a joke. Okay? One can joke. It's constitutional to joke. Is that right, JJ? Right. Sorry, I withdraw that. It was never meant to be anything more serious. Comrade Phillips, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, I think Mr. Hubert assisted a lot when he said there were some recommendations. Some recommendations that were difficult or maybe impossible to implement.
I wonder how long you'll survive having said that, but let's see. It is that bad.
Chair, firstly, the mechanism that the judge has proposed to remedy the issue about ministerial accountability was mentioned as section 97 of the Constitution. Now, it's a very short section. The President, by proclamation, may transfer to a member of the Cabinet the administration of any legislation entrusted to another member or any power or function entrusted by legislation to another member. Now, if we look at the NPA Act, there's no provision which say the Minister of Justice is responsible so-and-so and so for the DSO. In other words, there's no specific legislative provision that you can take and transfer to the Minister for Safety and Security in order to effect that accountability. And maybe Mr. Daniels, Enver Daniels, can maybe say whether he's in agreement. I think in that sense, that recommendation was not implementable. Secondly, Chair, you have mentioned from the comments that I've made that the command structure of the DSO lies mostly with the prosecution authority. Now, firstly, the other recommendation of Judge Kompepe was that the members of the, or the investigators of the DSO must be placed under the accountability of the Independent Complaints Directorate. Now, exactly the same problem. If I am an investigator, I'm executing an operation under the command of an advocate of the DSO, and I'm called to accountability to the ICD, I'm just going to tell him I executed the instructions that I received from the prosecutor, and the prosecutor doesn't become subject to the accountability of the ICD. The same, and the judges really, and that is one point where the judges agreed with the police service, in respect of the disjunction of ministerial accountability. And you must firstly look at the broad mandate and the job of the Minister for Safety and Security in respect of crime combating in the country. And I'm not going to the issue about one police service. I think that thing has been settled long ago. But the issue that he is responsible to account to Parliament in combating crime. And the judge very specifically mentioned, and I'm not going to read long part of the... But the commission, you see, the staff pointed out that in terms of determining priorities in a holistic fashion, the Minister for Safety and Security must have authority to determine all priorities and threats in the country. The SAFS describes a situation where some of the most important threats relating to organized crime operationally fell out of the command and control of the Minister for Safety and Security. The SAFS argued that the arrangement did not reflect sound principles of governance. And then the judge says, this argument is, in my view, compelling. It is both untenable and anomalous that the Minister for Safety and Security, who has the responsibility to address the overall policing investigative needs and priorities of the Republic, should not exercise any control over the investigative component of the DSO. And if I can come back then, how does he account to Parliament on the investigative component if they are being the command and control of that investigator's lies with the NPA? Once again, the disjunction in ministerial responsibility is not remedied by just making the minister accountable for that. And I can go on in the same vein regarding intelligence. There's also a minister, from intelligence. So, Chair, to come back to the question, if you look at each and one of the, everyone, there are two major issues that were not implemented in the bill. The one is about the placement. Yes, the judge did say they can stay where they are. That has not been taken into account because the decision was made contrary to that. The second one was about that abbreviation, the vetting structure that must be set up. Here, I think if you have a structure that functions outside the police service and doing this type of work, you would need a structure for coordination. But as I've told the committee previously, there are so many coordinating structures of which the SAPS is part. We are part of the National Intelligence Coordinating Committee, all the other interdepartmental structures, which the DSO not necessarily is part of. Those are mainly the issues that have not been addressed. And if you can go to all the other issues, the vetting. Vetting is addressed here. The issue about the oversight of the ICD. All these people will become SAFS members, they will become subject to the oversight of the ICD. So yes, definitely we took cognizance of each and every recommendation. And I think the solution that's offered by the bill actually brings in accountability and it takes away ministerial disjunction. And I hear what the committee has said, even if we have to strengthen ministerial accountability. But by having two ministers responsible, and one of them, in terms of the constitution, is responsible for crime, and another minister to have to take, and I'm talking about investigation of crime, of course, the NPA also deal with crime, criminal matters. So, Chair, what I'm saying, definitely, the Comptroller Commission report was informative to this, and as Mr. Hubert has said, some of those recommendations might not have been easily or at all implementable, and but what we have here may solve most of the problematic areas, which when I presented it was said it was skewed. If it was, I apologize for that, but I never intended to make a full submission of the Gampepe report. I related it to the contents of the bill. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Can I just say something? I think the committee is concerned to see coordination, especially as we're moving in the direction one model is, I think all the models are, to bring in FICA and SARS and so on. We're all saying that it's important to bring immigration and so on in. The problem is you can't effect coordination, especially in a seconded system. That's what you're going for. And all we're simply saying is coordination. Now, one form it will take is an MCC, which is even broader this time because you have to include Home Affairs and so on, and the Minister of Finance, actually, because that's where some of the SARS stuff will fall under. I don't think it's the political structure that people are concerned so much about. That will meet maybe three or four times a year. It's really the coordinating technical structure that requires the officials to meet and ensure the operational day-to-day cooperation. And even for those of you going for Model 1, we all agree we should expand to include SARS, Speaker, Financial Intelligence, everything, immigration and so on, point one. Point two is that we have now come to an end. It's lunchtime. I think, Annelies, these questions that you drafted, the opposition's agreed to. the text, yeah. Okay, so we will deal with these questions next week, but these questions have to be answered in the open committee. So I think really we can slide it into the model of the discussion, but the subcommittee will have to present your answers, or you'll the following week will be in open committee. Then there's a request to you about lost car keys. Lost on Tuesday somewhere around the old assembly. They are the credit card type key. It's squarish in shape, black with a Renault Megane sign on the front. Remember, this is a good choice because I've got a Renault too. Although I've got the Scenic, I think it's better than the Megane. Anyway, they are on a diamond-shaped keyring, which also has a blue remote control attached to it. If anyone finds them, please hand them over to the security desk on V12. So they lost yesterday. Please help if you found it. It's one of the journalists who was actually covering us yesterday. And obviously, he will write very good stories about us if we find the keys for him. So we have a vested interest in helping out. As I understand it, we are ahead of time. Even though I've been rattling on, and I'm impressed with myself, Comrade Co-Chair, I know you're not. If we come back at 2, if all goes well, the structure of the DSO SAPS will take 15, 20 minutes each way. And then the organized crime thing, we will deal with it in open committee. And what I'm suggesting is that the closed part we can deal with it next Tuesday. You know, so if all goes well, we should be able to leave at 3:30. Not 5, 3:30. You can applaud the co-chairs later. We'll be gratefully, graciously receiving it. And we can all go out and play in the rain. It's a way of relieving tension. Okay? Diane and John Jeffrey in particular should pair up and go out there in the rain and play in it. And the puddles that are out there and so on. While I read my novel, which I have stopped reading for the last 6 weeks. Sorry, Baba? What's your point? Yeah, we're going to do that. I mean this very afternoon. What else have we got to do? It's raining out there. We can go and play in the rain. So, at half past 3, we shall be over if all goes well. We thank you all. 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock. Even the journalists can join us.